Are you talking about real witches with broomsticks and cats?
Well, I don't know about the broomsticks and cats.
Friday will be May Eve, Rood Mass. Then you'll see for yourself.
Let's change the subject.
Well, I've never heard of Rood Mass.
Well, it's supposed to be one of the four great Sabbaths of the year when the witches gather. Candlemas, Roodmas, Beltane in midsummer, and Halloween, the night the witches make their sacrifice to the devil.
Well, I can hardly wait for Friday. I gather Bill hasn't told you what kind of a family you've married into.
I'll knock it off, Todd.
Oh, no, I'm really interested. What kind of a family have I married into?
What harm will it do?
Well, you started it. You better finish it.
The Laniers are Norman stock, latecomers. The Whitlocks were Anglo-Saxon. Originally, they owned all this land, this house. The story goes that in the early 1600s, during the witch hunts, the Laniers accused the Whitlocks of witchcraft. There have been cynics who felt that their zeal was inspired more by greed than righteousness. But anyway, they had Vanessa Whitlock killed and drove out her kinfolk. Then they took over. Well, naturally, the Whitlocks didn't take very kindly to this. And ever since then, they're supposed to have made the destruction of the Laniers the main item of business at their Sabbaths.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 28th of April 2023. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre, but with Martin and I both remote. Me in central London, have been attending the National Union of Journalists Conference, which is at the Trade Union Congress. Today and tomorrow, finishes tomorrow evening. That's up in Great Russell Street, up at near Tottenham Court Road tube station. And very interesting bunch they are. And if you want to chat to some of the journalists, you'll find them in the breaks, smoking profusely outside TUC headquarters. And so we are broadcasting actually from Bristol and from our various remote places on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please, though, don't get it from the Google Play Store. Anywhere else will do, and you'll find various other app stores on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops, smearing also that 30 pence a pill ivermectin, the COVID treatment which could have saved 60,000 British lives with retrospect, and Matt Hancock's, as Dr. David Hughes described them from Lincoln University, crimes against humanity. That's all vanished, of course, overnight because we've got a Ukraine psyop going now, with dark enlightenment zombies waging war on the British people, as well as Putin now. So this is what the BBC might sound like were it free from the tentacles of authoritarian deep state lobbies. And as Martin quite rightly pointed out last week, unfortunately we don't quite have the same resources to fact check all the way through as the BBC, and we do occasionally get things wrong. Like, for example, last week I was talking about Mary Quant, the fashion designer, as being part of the Quant family. Well, she may have been related in some way, but certainly she wasn't a daughter of those who were making the money from slave labour camps, making batteries for the Nazis during the Second World War. And then they cashed all their money in and bought up BMW after the war. So Mary Quant, no, there's not necessarily any connection there. So, you know, just fessing up to these various mistakes. Sometimes we do make mistakes. We all make mistakes. Diane Abbott even makes mistakes sometimes. So navigating us through the Fourth Reich matrix, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Now, looking at this week, we're going to have a clip I recorded an hour or so ago, maybe an hour and a half, at the NUJ conference from John McDonnell MP. He's one of the conveners of the NUJ cross-party parliamentary group, and it's fascinating to hear the amount of work that some of these MPs are doing to try to make sure journalism functions democratically in Britain and bringing up concerns that journalists have. So well done to John McDonnell. I don't often say that here. It's been an interesting conference. We've had electronic voting going on for the first time, although there was, I think, the last conference, which was a virtual conference during COVID. And so there are some people happy with it, other people very unhappy with it. And I'd imagine at the next conference there'll be all sorts of motions about that, because it seems to take a lot longer to do the voting using this weird electronic method. Chatting to people about Palestine settlements. One chap is just back from Palestine. All sorts of fascinating people. But anyway, it's a cancellation week, isn't it? With Diane Abbott and Andrew Bridgen both being cancelled from their respective parties. Yet again, more cancellation. We've got the teacher strike on Thursday. Martin will be talking about that. But focusing in on Bristol, we're going to be looking at Common Purpose and comparing the analysis from Mark Anderson on UK Column on Monday to an interview we recorded with Sam Downey back in 2017, would you believe, talking about exactly the same thing. And the interview with Sam Downey was there subsequently banned by Patrick Hart, who was our station manager, and we were ordered to take it off the internet, even though somebody, you're going to hear a clip of that tonight. Maybe that's why, because it was incredibly prescient, almost prophetic, about the functioning of the city under Marvin Rees, the mayor, and his global parliament of mayors, and his affiliation to the Yale World Fellows and the World Economic Forum. We'll be looking a bit at the coronation. We'll have John Morgan, the guy who's dead now, but his comment on the Way Ahead group, which was where King Charles's private secretary at the time was trying to manage the situation with Diana when she died. And also we'll be looking, taking a, I think, a fascinating look at the Extinction Rebellion protests. It's called the big one going on in London at the moment. But a critical view of that from a former miner and still a member of the National Union of Mine Workers, David Douglas. So a debate between Shane Collins from the Green Party and David Douglas on what is a zero carbon agenda. And also I said to them, look, what do you think is the future for energy in Britain? In part two, President Xi from China has made a phone call to President Zelensky, trying to make peace over there, I suppose, but I'm not sure quite how far he's going to get. We've also got record global military spending announced by the Swedish this week. Robert Kennedy last weekend gave an amazing speech, 2 hours long, to announce his standing for presidency. So we've got a clip from that. Plus, we've got Cynthia Chung, who Martin mentioned a few weeks ago. So yeah, sometimes I actually do listen to Martin, and when he says something, says someone's interesting, I did seek her out. He's talking about eugenics. She's talking about eugenics, and particularly about the legacy of Aldous Huxley. Very interesting woman she is too. Tucker Carlson's been cancelled, so we've got a clip from him, a couple of clips, I think, maybe. And there's this amazing, well, it is incredible, documentary out by Vera Sharav, S-H-A-R-A-V, called Never Again Is Now. Now, she's from a family of Holocaust survivors talking about what's going on in the world today. Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. So, Martin, I thought we'd start looking at Bristol with the rather horrifying announcement. Well, we've got something like 500 people, we reckon, living in vans and caravans in Bristol who can't afford rent. I mean, what do you make of this move of people out of houses into vehicles and caravans? Because this is the sort of thing that happened also, didn't it, in the 1980s. And these people just simply cannot afford to live.
Well, I mean, if you look at the United States, large numbers of people live in tents or in vehicles, and that's been the case for decades. And as we modernise and become more Americanised, now we've left the EU, that's what's going to happen to us. And it's going to happen all over the world in most developed countries because of what's happening with the economy.
Well, it is interesting the way you bring the EU in on everything, but I mean, this was going this was going well before we left the EU. The increase, in fact, the interview I did, which is about are we going to see another second traveller revolution, well before we left the EU. Now, I mean, the fact is that rents are just being racked up, aren't they? And there isn't really any proper rent controls.
Well, my rent's just been increased by £85 a month. And if I don't pay it, I'll be evicted. And that's true for everybody. Lots of people are going to end up homeless as a result of this. And it's going to happen all over the world. But as I say, in the United States, this has been the norm for decades.
Yeah, but it's not true for travellers, is it? If you're a traveller, that one of the things that you're basically paying your car tax and your car insurance. But other than that, there's not a lot of overheads. And I think this is a brilliant way to, I mean, some of these vehicles are amazing. I mean, I've seen some like converted coaches and goodness knows what, which, you know, they may be costing something like £10,000-£20,000, maybe another 10 on top of that to get the conversion done. But they're really quite luxurious. And so one does wonder, especially, you know, with a coach, you sometimes will get twice the floor space that you will in a, say, a one-bedroom flat, for example. But the story, what they're saying in Bristol 24/7 this week, by Alex Seabrook, who's one of the local Democracy reporters in Bristol, bless him, new parking charges on the Downs considered in plan to drive away van dwellers. Well, they call them van dwellers. This is a kind of handy way of calling them. But actually, that's usually because the human rights legislation guarantees special rights for travellers, but not van dwellers. Now, I don't know what the difference between them is, but anyway, I wouldn't personally be using the word van dweller. I would say use the word travellers. But anyway, so new parking charges on the Downs are being considered in a plan to drive away van dwellers. There's something like 100 vehicles up on the Downs, including caravans. So they say 60. There's more than that, most definitely. But there is something called the Downs Committee, which is where the merchant venturers sit down with some of the Bristol councillors. Councillor Paula O'Rourke, on the 25th of April, she's Lord Mayor and Chair of the committee, said she was concerned about the safety of gas canisters used by many van dwellers, as well as pushing them to live elsewhere across Bristol. Well, at least she's acknowledging that you're just moving the problem on if you're trying to get rid of people from the Downs. So, Martin, what can be done about this? The Downs is actually a fairly sensible place for them to be, it seems to me, because they're not really in anybody's way, because there's a massive amount of parking around that big green area up beyond Clifton.
Well, I'm not quite sure. The Downs are actually jointly managed by the council and merchant venturers, but I think it's the merchant venturers who own it, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, it is.
Well, in that case, they're in a position, if they own it, to say you can't use it. I mean, they shouldn't be. Maybe the Downs ought to be publicly owned, but there you are.
Well, it's a grey area, isn't it? Because some of the roads, obviously, are public roads, which are managed by the council.
Yes, and I think whatever you do with something like this, it's the same with the boat people in the harbour. The council has got to recognise that if you just say you're going to remove these people, where are they going to go? But you can see why those who own control. I mean, that's what capitalism is all about. You know, that's it.
There was an amazing proposal last year. I saw one of the roads, I think it's Parry's Lane, which they park on both sides of Parry's Lane. There was a proposal by the merchant venturers at the Downs Committee that Parry's Lane be dug up with a bulldozer and turned back into the Downs again. So the idea is that that's back to their jurisdiction. So, and also the people can't park there. But there is this very much this kind of othering, isn't it, of the people that live up there. They're not really seen as human because they're not paying enough council tax.
Well, I think they are just regarded as a nuisance by the respectable citizens represented by the
merchant. But in what way are they actually a nuisance other than being there?
Well, I would agree with you, Tony, but from their point of view, they think in terms of tourism to Bristol and people taking their dogs for a walk on the Downs and having people living in vans. It's just messy, isn't it? And it sort of spoils the view and all the rest of it.
Well, I mean, to be honest, the areas where they are, the areas where the vans are kind of out of the way, really. They're out of the way, the vehicles.
Well, I tend to agree with you, because even if you move them off there, they'll have to go somewhere else. They're, as you say, they're out of the way, whereas you've got vans in a community, like Easton, where we've had quite a lot of people living in vans. That can be problematic if they're going to have loud parties and things like that. There's always going to be give and take about anything like this.
Well, there's none of this. There's very little of that at all. I mean, it's not really a place people live there. They're not really having loud. I mean, some of these places have had parties. Usually it's the van dwellers and the caravan dwellers themselves that put a stop to it.
Well, yes, I mean, there's no use generalising about people who live in vans or live in houses, is there? Some are going to be quite respectable and responsible and others less so, but that's true of people who live in houses, isn't it?
Yeah, it's almost like, I suppose if you or I were in that situation, Martin, we might decide, well, look, you know, it's very, very difficult to afford to pay the rent. So maybe a van is the best option. I mean, it's a, I mean, particularly for young families, you know, many of them, say young couples, for example, thinking of having children or even with children, have just decided, look, there's no way we can afford this rent and look after the kids. We're going to have to either, say, move into a boat or a vehicle or a caravan.
Well, people are increasingly going to have to do this, as has been the norm, as I mentioned, in the United States for decades. Millions of people live in houses and tents. People who can't always necessarily afford a vehicle, they end up living in tents. And that's just the norm in the United States. And, of course, they don't vote in elections. They don't have any say in anything. And, of course, if you've got small children living in a van, there's an issue of which schools they're going to go to. Because if you get moved on, then they can't stay in the schools that they're in at the moment.
Well, as also I've been hearing from some of the travellers themselves in Bristol that the city council has started proceedings against is it five different sites, I believe, in the city? What, the Downs is only one of them. And obviously this idea of parking charges up there is just one way to try and obviously they know that these people just don't have the money to pay parking charges, and so they will be bankrupted by this. So the Downs, Green Bank, a place near St George's Park, and Speedwell School near the rugby ground, as well as Stadium Road near IKEA. So that's the five main sites where travellers around Bristol have been congregating, Martin. There's an attempt by the council to get an injunction. It looks like it's there is no hearing for it at the moment because the council are trying to gather more evidence to get them all excluded from these zones.
Well, I know there's been tension about this for many years, and that council has often tried to move people on from these sites. This is nothing new in a way, is it? And, of course, from a political point of view, these people generally tend not to be registered to vote. So people who want to win elections to the council don't necessarily get any brownie points for being nice to them. They should be. There needs to be a negotiation about all of these things. But political power is what it is, isn't it? And if you don't participate in the system, you're not part of the system. You don't get a voice.
So it's a claim, claim number GM07, G for golf, M for mother, 07-318 at the County Court of Bristol, Bristol Civil Justice Centre, Redcliffe Street. So if anyone wants to follow it up and find out what's going on, which, you know, we will be doing too, that's the claim. Because this is, I mean, Bristol is the thing that makes Bristol unique, Martin, I think, is that there's so many people that work on the festival season during the summer. So although this is coming in now, it may be that many of these people aren't even around to contest these injunction or the parking charges, that sort of thing, because they'll be off on the festival season.
Well, that may be so. I don't know. I mean, possibly some will, some won't.
Well, many of them work at the festivals, don't they? I mean, you know, Bristol is a place where festival workers come to live during the winter.
Well, yes, but I don't suppose all of them are festival workers. You can't presume that, can you?
Well, of course they're not. I'm not saying that.
This needs to be found. The idea that you can just clear all these people off and tidy it all up and they'll just disappear and that'll be the end of it. Because, as you say, because rents are so high, it's virtually impossible. If you've got irregular work, for example, it's much easier to have no rent to pay, and then you can just do irregular work and get little bits and bobs. If you've got a regular rent to pay, that takes more than half whatever you're earning. And, of course, that is the situation that many people are in, and that's why the economy is stalled and probably about to fall into a deep dive.
OK, so what is Labour's policy, do you think, here? Because this, of course, is a Labour mayor behind this. He doesn't seem to have a policy. There's we've already heard last week, I think it was, that or maybe a week before, that the housing waiting list has just been torn in half and half of them thrown away. So that's not really a way of cutting the housing list. It's just by saying, well, these people are never going to get housed, so tough. And this doesn't really seem to be Labour policy to me. It seems more like Tory policy being implemented in Bristol against the travellers and against the homeless. So why is Labour behaving like this?
Well, as I pointed out earlier, these people tend not to be registered to vote and don't vote. Other people nearby, surrounding the Downs, are registered to vote and they do vote. and they often are quite hostile to these people. So if you want to get re-elected, it may be that you've got to throw red meat to those kind of voters.
Well, it's not surprising. And that's true of any political party. It's not surprising they don't vote, is there, when there's nobody to vote for?
Well, that's true, but they're not even registered because they haven't got a stable address. So that, you know, that then creates further problem. And in any case, you may say there's nobody to vote for. There isn't. The system's rigged. We all know that. It's a first-past-the-post system, so even your vote doesn't necessarily count. There's all sorts of things wrong with our society. And
there's another thing wrong with us. I mean, I find it disgusting that people vote for an alternative to the Tories in a Labour mayor in Bristol, and all they get is the same.
Well, it's not quite the same.
Yes, it is. It's the same. That's what they're doing. They're trying to evict travellers rather than provide sites for them. And, I mean, there is a site I think they've provided, but there's nowhere near enough room for these 500 or so vehicles and caravans. And then to have the Greens weighing in as well, saying, oh, we mustn't have anyone with a gas bottle, it's too dangerous and blah, blah, blah. You know, look, people need gas. Like, I bet she's got gas in her house. But anyway, so the next story, a schoolgirl's life is being made a misery by unisex toilets, apparently. This is in Coventry, on Coventry Live, which is the Reach PLC paper up there. A mum has shared her fury after claiming her daughter's fears changing her sanitary products at a secondary school. She said unisex toilets have caused a number of problems at the Cauldron Castle School. Her teenage daughter was diagnosed with a kidney problem, 6 months old. It means she definitely has to use the toilet when she knows she needs to go. And more frequently, the mum said, needs of her 14-year-old daughter have not been taken into consideration despite repeated pleas to the leaders at Cauldron Castle School. She has been refused to go to the toilet during lessons and also fears changing her sanitary towels inside the unisex toilet. Now, apparently there was also a previous incident where one of the boys in these toilets was kicking down the doors of the girls whilst they were in the toilets. I mean, this whole idea of unisex toilets, well, it may be very woke, Martin, but do you think it'll work?
Well, yes. If you're going to have cubicle toilets, then they've got to be proper cubicles, haven't they? Which shut the doors shut, nobody can see under them, and all the rest of it. And, of course, in some places, they just have a toilet that everybody uses, and there's one toilet, the door locks.
I mean, is this appropriate for these teenagers?
Well, there used to be provision of urinals, for example, in France, les pissoirs, as they used to be called, and they were only for blokes, you know.
Well, in public? We're talking about in a school here.
Yes, I know.
So These girls don't have any privacy, do they? Why should boys be allowed to, you know, stand outside the toilets, shout and laugh whilst they're in there changing their sanitary towel?
You find some places have got this new idea of we're all going to use the same toilets. If you're going to do that, then you've got to build toilets which are usable on an individual basis.
So is it okay if this girl is too scared to change sanitary towels when she comes on her periods monthly and her pads have apparently come through onto her uniform? This is a horrific kind of bullying. These kids have got no privacy. That's what it seems to me, particularly this young girl here.
Yes, well, I mean, if there are issues with this, then they should be resolved. I mean, maybe we shouldn't just still have boys and girls toilets as we always used to.
Well, she says her young daughter has made excuses just to go home so she can change her sanitary towels during the day. I mean, this is the sort of fallout, I suppose, from this idea that they've got a photograph here of the toilets, which is there's only one toilet and the boys can bang on the doors, kick the doors if they want to. It just seems to me that, you know, both sexes need a bit of privacy. I mean, I don't know, you know, you went to a school where there were boys' toilets, I've no doubt, Martin, and the boys used to hang around in there and cause trouble. I mean, maybe the girls used to, I don't know what went on in the girls' toilets, I was never in there. But the boys' toilets were certainly a place where the boys would get, you know, particularly the bullies, would hang around and wait for someone, you know, unsuspecting person, girl or boy in this case now, to come in and face their wrath.
Well, that's why, in actual fact, it's an issue, particularly in secondary schools, that toilets are not, in fact, entirely private and that teachers can come in there because of the issues that you've mentioned, like, you know, vaping, harassment and so on. You know, schools have got to just have consistent policies that everybody understands, and they've got to take account of the various needs of the various kids they've got.
Well, I mean, I suppose part of this is that, you know, it's partly to do with the privatisation of schools, isn't there? There isn't any sort of one standard that makes sure this sort of thing can't happen.
Well, it's presumably decided by individual schools with the governors and so on being included. And I think it stems from this whole idea, as you know, of, you know, children being able to identify as the opposite sex, which I think is, you know, these issues are, you know, extremely controversial.
Maybe they need three sets of toilets. I mean, this is the answer, surely, to have three sets of toilets, a unisex toilet and a girls and a boys, so the kids can go wherever they feel most comfortable. But the idea of forcing the boys into the girls' toilets, to me, just sounds absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I say, there are ways around this. I mean, in lots of places, they have a disabled toilet, which often has baby-changing facilities or whatever, which has a lockable door. Just for individuals.
Well, I can tell you at Congress House with the TUC, they have separate male and female toilets, which I was quite pleased to see. Anyway, let's just move on now to look at the common purpose influence on Bristol, because that's certainly what seems to be going on here. On Monday this week, the UK column carried what I thought was quite an interesting it was long, I think it was around about 20 minutes, explanation by Mark Anderson, calling over from the United States, doing an interesting analysis of some of the statements made by the various groups that people like our Mayor Marvin Rees and the London Mayor Sadiq Khan are part of, these global city groups, the Parliament of Mayors, this kind of thing, and being very critical, and I think quite rightly, of the idea that you elect a mayor of Bristol and then he decides he's going to take on a global role as a global change agent and jet around the world pontificating on international issues such as Ukraine and particularly these issues to do with climate. But anyway, it seems to me that what might be happening is that other things are being neglected along the road. So let's have a listen now to Mark Anderson, and we'll be hearing in a minute from Sam Downey from this recording we did back in 2017 on the UK column this week.
The Global Parliament of Mayors is one of the key cornerstones of this whole U7 operation. The Global Parliament of Mayors is a governance body. So these mayors come together without any authority that I'm aware of from their city charters or their national constitutions. They come together, and by virtue of that alone, they believe they have the lawful authority to govern. So they call themselves a governance body of, by, and for mayors from all continents with a vision of the world in which mayors, their cities, and networks and are equal partners in building global governance. Equal partners. So they're now equal partners with nation states to build global governance for an inclusive, of course, and sustainable world. Its mission is to facilitate debates between mayors, national governments, and international organizations, which is a bunch of private, unelected orgs, drive systematic change to take on global and national challenges and opportunities to achieve political change on a global scale. So you can see what's happening. Everything's getting hardwired now. And this is the other chief private organization like the Global Parliament of Mayors that's involved in this. And this is the Local Governments for Sustainability I mentioned a few minutes ago. Local Governments for Sustainability is a global network of more than 2,500 local and regional governments committed to sustainable urban development. ECLI, I'm going to roughly pronounce the acronym. Its members and team of experts work together in over 125 countries through peer exchange partnerships and capacity building to create systemic change for urban sustainability, more globalese buzzwords, and to respond to complex global challenges. Local Governments for Sustainability brings the latest global knowledge and solutions to the local context. So they're localizing globalism, or glocalism, as they sometimes euphemistically call it. And I believe this is the last posting to describe and represent, or to give an overview of this. Here we have the U7 group's, one of their main statements from their website. The U7 group invites the G7 countries and G7 engagement groups to recognize the U7 as the new G7 engagement group and thereby acknowledge the importance of these objectives. This includes the engagement in G7 ministerial meetings focusing on the topic of city diplomacy. Here's that theme again, that cities believe they have the prerogative and authority to actually conduct diplomacy, usually reserved to nation states, and multi-level cooperation and overall cooperation by effectively engaging in local and regional governments in G7 meetings. The ultimate aim of the U7 engagement group will be to represent the interests of cities, municipalities, and regional governments. Its core will consist of national associations of cities supported by international city networks, as we've learned. Thus, the U7 engagement group will form a bridge between local and national governments. That is really describing what this is about. The U7 engagement group will form a bridge between local and national governments, offering local actors, kind of a strange choice of words there, offering these local actors, an opportunity to join forces and better position themselves in international political processes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As the first step towards establishing the official U7 engagement group, the Urban 7 Group Alliance hosted the U7 Mayor's Summit with the theme Embracing the Urban World, Cities as Drivers for Peace, Democracy, and Sustainability. And come to think of it, I think I wrote a final statement on this. This is some of my writing in a preliminary article that I'll soon be submitting. It talks a little bit about who's been involved. I'll just pull out a couple names. Peter Kurz, the mayor of Mannheim, Germany, chairman of the Global Parliament of Mayors, and another very significant one. His name comes up again and again and again in global cities parlance, and that's Marvin Rees right over there in Bristol, UK, chairman of the UK Core Cities, which actually created the Urban Seven. So Marvin Rees is up to his neck in this thing. And you've got Alberta, Canada involved, Des Moines, Iowa, of all places, and Fort Collins, Colorado, et cetera. So there's a declaration that was made. I'll read part of it. I have another monitor here. Part of this declaration from the mayor's summit that happened recently this spring. Therefore, we mayors and leaders of the Urban 7 group gathered through the networks of local governments of G7 nations and European multi-level governance under Germany's G7 presidency in 2022. They applaud the G7's unprecedented recognition of Urban 7 cities and sustainable development, sustainable urban development and multi-level governance. I might have misread that a little bit, but I don't know if you guys have any comments or observations. I had one more on that slide. I had one more thing to read on the prior one.
Yes. Well. Look, Mark. The key point here is, isn't it, that we notionally live in so-called democratic societies. We elect representatives to represent us at a national level and represent us with other international bodies and organizations and countries through diplomacy. And what's effectively happening here is that people that are either unelected or they're pseudo-elected, but they're elected on the basis of providing services at a local level, collecting the bins and keeping the streetlights on. These people are now deciding that they want to be involved in the international conversations. And why? Because for whatever ideological reasons, they are wanting to get involved in the climate change agenda, in the gender and sexuality discussions and so on at an international level, and do diplomacy at an international level, subverting in some ways. And David, I'd be interested to hear whether you think that the word subverting is inappropriate here, subverting the national conversation and national discussion, because of course we're not having conversations, people aren't having conversations with their local mayors about international policies.
No, subverting's one way of putting it. Another way is the old common purpose mantra of operate beyond your authority. I mean, that this is an example par excellence of that. The fact that it was founded by a British group, I think is very interesting. Also, the constituents of that, it's Belfast, Birmingham, Bristol, Cardiff, Glasgow, Leeds, Liverpool, Manchester, Newcastle, Nottingham and Sheffield. Not Edinburgh, not London, which is interesting. Glasgow, remember, is having problems with rat infestations and collecting the bins, so much so that the Glaswegian bin men have got a giant inflatable rat called Cludgy, the rat, that they use for campaigning about the dangers that their members are experiencing collecting the bins in Glasgow.
Well, that's the first I've heard of Cludgy the rat, Martin. I mean, this does certainly look... I mean, it's interesting. He's bringing in this whole idea of common purpose at the end there. I'm not quite sure who that was, but it was on the UK Column programme on Monday. Mike Robinson, you heard in the middle there. He's... I keep getting little indications that he really doesn't like our program. I don't quite know why. It's the sort of thing that would be, you know, be useful to be able to sort of contribute to the UK Column. So if anybody is in touch with Mike Robinson at UK Column, it'd be interesting to get an answer as to what is the problem with the not the BCFM politics show. I'd love to hear from Mike. I've tried contacting himself, hadn't had a reply, but anyway. The point here being, it's interesting, isn't it, also that the list of cities he read out, Martin, there, is all the major cities bar the capitals as well. So it's almost like the capitals are quite controlled anyway, but they want to make sure that none of these cities kind of goes off in its own direction, it seems to me.
Well, the core cities, as I understand it, has been a long-standing organisation of the biggest city, you know, the local leadership of the biggest cities in Britain. So that's what that is. And of course, different cities have different political setups. We won't be having a mayor in the mayor's parliament after next year because there won't be a mayor in Bristol. So we won't be sending any mayor to the mayor's parliament, will we? We won't be able to. What actually happens at local level is pretty much what happens at national level, is that the people who are elected do what they want. And if you don't like it, you vote them out.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've had hundreds of years of local government in Bristol with the city council, yeah. And we've never, ever had a mayor before that decides that he's going to be a globetrotter on the world stage, you know, going off to do these TED Talks and things like that.
Well, we've never had a mayor before Ferguson was elected.
Right, or council Ferguson, leader. No,
Ferguson, I mean, went around on the world stage, perhaps not as much as Marvin.
Well, none of them did. Certainly no. Yeah, well, George Ferguson, that's right, was a kind of beginning of this. But anyway, the main reason I wanted to play that is because it had echoes of this incredible conversation that was censored by the BCFM boss, Patrick Hart, at the behest of, maybe I should dig out those old emails and letters, because it was Mike Zeidler and Liz Zeidler at Bristol Happy City that wrote to Pat saying that they were rather upset about our programme, which was quite critical of Bristol Happy Cities. In fact, I think it's just called Happy Cities, and it happened to be based in Bristol. And now it's changed its name to something which I'll dig out and tell you after we've heard this clip, which we recorded back in 2017 with Sam Downey, and then was subsequently censored. But it's on a very similar theme. He's really saying, talking about this whole idea of people being elected to become, the chairman of the parish council, and then deciding that they want to rule the world.
Bristol Health Partners have made it now public knowledge that they're working with Common Purpose, running these leadership training sessions with different organisers.
So this conference was the annual conference, and it was held at Bristol just recently, a few weeks ago.
Yes.
One of the things from the programme that I found quite shocking was, and it's all about leadership, supposedly, is it was teaching participants at the conference to lead beyond their authority.
Yes.
So that means to say, effectively, to try to make decisions that you're not actually allowed to make.
Yeah.
So in other words, to sort of strong arm and cajole your superiors into doing things that you want.
Yeah, exactly. And also that same expression, when I've looked into it, and the common purpose means of it, means that it's to... So, leading beyond their authority. So, if you look at authority as law, So what is beyond the law? Which that actually, that meaning, it means breaking the law.
Yes, it could be civil or criminal offences being committed. Exactly. Also interesting that that somebody from Common Purpose or the Common Purpose Conference, somebody from Happy Cities pops up as one of the main speakers.
Yeah. This person is called David Ralph. And
okay, so who's he?
He's a director at Happy City. He's also the director of Bristol Health Partners as well.
Crikey. And what's his background?
His background is from the army, from Wiltshire.
Right. So does he have any health experience? He worked in the health service?
No, I've met him, and he's told me he has some experience in management, and that's it. So he's not health or medically trained at all. He also recently did some training at an event at Bristol City Council on the subject of welfare, and he did a whole session about ESA and PIP. Of course, so he's not actually versed in those things and doesn't know anything about benefits or benefit cuts.
So this Bristol Health Partners sounds like a rather peculiar organisation. What about they have something at the conference called the immersion.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds almost like biblical, like a kind of baptism.
Yes.
What is the immersion of Common Purpose at Bristol Health Partners?
So the immersion is to immerse their people who are from different organisations to do a lot of peer-led exercises. They went to, for example, the South Mead Development Trust and to learn about basically it was a spy mission, let's call it, to learn about the organisation, to learn what they do, and then to bring back what they've learned about that organisation. And the next stage is, I don't know, what to try to imply it and to bring it into other organisations. I kind of don't think that's the idea of it. Or is it a way to how to destroy that organisation to go back to it? And now you know the inside.
Certainly
it
could be intelligence gathering or possibly even brainwashing. Yeah, but I mean, I suppose immersion means actually going out and about and seeing what's going on out there. Anyway, also, what Common Purpose, another thing they were doing at this conference, is this thing called galaxy mapping. Now,
yes,
it does
indeed
sound like the sort of thing that might be okay for a classroom of five-year-olds, but these are all, you know, mature adults.
They are.
Galaxy mapping. So they're sort of taking them through the planetarium of Common Purpose.
The planetarium.
How are they doing
of,
that?
Or the planetarium at Bristol, maybe, but no. Basically, what galaxy mapping means is this. How it works is so it's something that's really, really simple. So it's all about inference. So it's a inference board. So imagine you've got all the planets lined up in a line in front of you. And on
a conjunction of the planets,
yes,
on a great long on the plane about okay, it will cause all sorts of gravitational problems in the universe.
Oh,
but,
yeah,
anyway.
But so on the left hand side you have the mighty Sun. And somewhere in the middle we have Earth, next to Mars. And then to the other side you've got Pluto, Neptune, and then one other thing, and that's black holes. So how it works is this. The influencer is the Sun. So how galaxy mapping is, you're told about the Sun as the main influencer. So you apply that to people. Who are your influencers? Who are the main people to go to? The people that you will infiltrate. These are you now have a type for them, and they're called Suns. So this is coded language, basically.
Okay, so these are the kind of opinion formers, influencers in the organisation where you're working.
Yeah, or an outside organisation.
And also, they could say a target.
Yeah. Those are the kind of targets. But if you want another type of target, then you've got people who are labelled black holes. So these black holes are people who you want to go and harass, people who you want to go and stalk, people who you want to destroy their family and their work lives.
Wow. So what are you, Martin, a sun or a black hole?
Well, I mean, we've got this account from this chap of what he thinks went on in those meetings.
Well, it did go on. Yeah, he has photographs of it, so let's undermine Sam.
When he makes the statement there that people who are identified as black holes are to be harassed, that's something that I raises a question in my mind. What strikes me about all of this stuff, and when I used to work for the public sector and in other organisations I've worked for, an awful lot of time is wasted on training meetings of this sort. But it's absolutely endemic in any organisation. If you work in the City of London, you'll be sitting in meetings where...
Well, that doesn't mean to say it's right. Anyway, looking at the Happy City Initiative, that is now called the Centre for Thriving Places. So they've changed their name. Happy Cities is about happiness, they say, becoming the aim of life across Bristol. It helps us shift from bad news, fear and consumption to celebrating, spreading success, creating caring and connecting communities. Well, what this doesn't recognise is the cost of living crisis and the massive deliberate undermining by the ruling classes of people's living standards, and the idea that you're being told that consumption is wrong. Well, I mean, if it's overconsumption, but obviously you need to consume things to live, like, for example, food. So when they're now called the Centre for Thriving Spaces, this is Liz and Mike Zeidler again, plus that other chat we'll look at in a second. What they say is they were set up to challenge the belief that economic growth is the only measure of success in society. Well, this isn't really what's happening, is it? It's an economic recession, Martin. So they're really just setting up a kind of nonsense that they're saying, well, this is not the only measure. And their aim is to put well-being at the heart of public discourse. It seems to me that they're a kind of sticking plaster organisation, which are getting, you know, some sort of funding from goodness knows where to tell people to keep smiling they don't have enough to eat, they have to go to food banks, they lose their job, and they're crashing into the poverty barrier.
Well, this is the trouble with all well-meaning stuff, isn't it? Like setting up something like a Green Party, which doesn't have any power at all and never gets elected to any positions of authority, but it makes people feel better. Like recycling, it makes people feel a bit better. But the reality, as you say, is that there's going to be a banking collapse and a world war. That will probably make people quite unhappy.
I suppose they will be patting themselves on the back because Bristol has been named the happiest city in Britain, allegedly. I'm not quite so sure about that.
On what basis has that been calculated? I would like to know.
Well, it's probably according to Bristol Happy City. Let's not be too cynical. What's your understanding of Common Purpose? Because they seem to be an overarching organisation that spends a lot of time trying to get its people in key positions in the public sector.
Well, it's clearly an organisation with an organisational network, which some people obviously feel is useful to their careers to be associated with. Just as there are other organisational networks, like the obvious one being the Merchant Venturers, which is very useful for your career to be a member of. And there's all sorts of organisations like this out there. There's all sorts of different things that you can affiliate to, be part of, and so on. And that's why people, you know, and they become influential insofar as they are influential. As you say, they get funding and all the rest of it. And if it wasn't Common Purpose, it'd be something else, because that's how human, you know, this is how networks work, isn't it? Powerful networks, not so powerful.
Common Purpose. Martin, the thing is that these various public sector organisations want to sort of get along and do their job independently, and that's the whole reason that we elect people, is to get up and do their stuff as independent individuals and independent groups. And yet there's this kind of overarching thing going on, which is trying to make them all sort of get involved in lockstep together. Just looking at the... it was Gala Bingo that had a look at which cities were the best. Bristol beat Birmingham, Liverpool and Leeds to the top spot with a happiness rating of 7.3 out of 10, according to the research by online bingo company Gala. So I'm not quite sure just how accurate that was. What do you make of this link, though? Because Sam is there talking about something which does seem to be an organisation which is training people to do leadership roles, but it's very much not opaque, is it? It's not transparent at all. And what they do is they're basically, they're based up, their offices, last time I saw them anyway, were next door to Business West, up at Lee, near Lee Woods, right next door to the heart of the business community. And yet their organization is an influence organization, which is very secretive, and they don't give you any public information really about what they're up to.
Well, these kind of organizations are, as I say, endemic. It's probably a business-funded organization. I don't know, but I would guess, considering where they're located and so on. And, you know, things are either done formally or informally, but lots of business is done by networks of people.
And it's very, very interesting. Sam brought in there.
I can pick up the phone and have a word with so-and-so and see if we can fix something.
This is formalized.
You know, this is how journalists work as well.
A formal network, isn't it? This guy, David Ralph, that Sam mentioned there, who's from the army, he's actually seems to be almost have his finger in almost all different pies, many different. Anyway, he's a big campaigner for net zero. He's chairman of the Avon Wildlife Trust. Former boss of Bristol Health Partners, academic health science centre, working with providers and commissioners and university and councils to improve people's health. Well, this is, you know, mainly, it seems, an industry body. It doesn't look like a public body to me. And he's a member of the board of something called the Carbon Trust, our mission to accelerate the move to a decarbonised future. And if you look at the Carbon Trust, they are the pushers of this new market, Martin, in carbon credits.
Well, yes, we know that there's all of these organisations out there pushing this agenda, which has been funded by various people. Soros, etc., may have some money in it and all the rest of it. And there are people who make a living out of being in part of these networks. I mean, even if they didn't actually do anything which achieved anything, it creates jobs for them, if nothing else.
It's a kind of lobby, isn't it? The private lobby that's taking over the role of, you know, policy making from a rather.
Yeah, but private lobbies have always lobbied. I mean, policy making has never been completely separate from being lobbied by vested interests. In fact, you know, it just isn't. I mean, politics is, in fact, about, you know, struggles for power between different groups of people who've got different ideas about what to do. And of course, some places in some countries, there is, you know, a dominating power that decides everything that's going to happen, and other places less so. It's politics, politics, politics.
Yeah, so let's have a listen now to, I mean, because I'm at the Journalist Union conference here, I think it'd be useful to sort of do a bit of a recap on some of the things that have been coming up. As I said, the electronic voting here, I'm not at all happy about, and we'll be probably drawing up a motion for the next conference saying that we want to have. I mean, the main problem with it is it takes far longer than a show of hands. You know, so everyone's got a card. This is what you normally do, your delegate card. You hold it up in the air, and then the president or whoever is chairing that part of the conference can immediately see if it looks as if, you know, whether, you know, which side is winning. So you have for and against separate votes. And if it looks as if it's a fine line, then you have what they do is a written vote, so you have to hold your hand up and then go around and actually count them. And it would seem to me maybe the electronic voting, if you really have to use it, might be handy for finely balanced votes, but it's taking ages. And also, of course, sometimes you're fumbling for your little voting thing and you get to it and you've just missed the 20 seconds or whatever it is that you get to vote. So it's also I'm not saying that the NUJ is going to be hacked, but it is easy to hack if someone particularly wanted to, even just for fun. They could probably sit in the back of the hall and fix some of the votes, and people might be surprised. Oh, gosh, you know. Anyway, Martin, what's your thoughts about this electronic voting? I'm quite surprised to see the NUJ going down that road.
Well, I suppose when you're having conferences on Zoom, it is electronic voting inevitably.
No, because if you're on Zoom and you're stood there, you can have your hand up, can't you, on the on the screen?
Yeah, I mean, that would require somebody at the centre to counter. But, you know, when the infamous Bristol West Labour Party meeting on Zoom where the existing general committee was removed and replaced, there was lots of questions about what went on there with the control of the meeting on Zoom by non-elected officials, full-time officials. I think manipulation of political structures, whether electronic or non-electronic, is always going to be a problem. People want to win, so they try and make sure that they get the votes they want lined up so they can get what they want, and other people are trying to stop.
We had quite a good chat last week, didn't we, about the Dominion voting machine.
Yeah.
Court case with Rupert Murdoch. These people are, well, I mean, they're the darkest of the dark artists, really. The idea that the Dominion has had a reputational loss, I think, is a very, very good thing, almost by whatever means, because we should be extremely skeptical.
Murdoch has paid out to stop.
Well, he's had to, yeah. I mean, he's been left in a situation where if he loses that case, he might lose his media company. So, you know, he's left with no little choice. And we can talk about that a bit more later with Tucker Carlson and the fallout from that. But look, please, let's have a listen now to Labour MP John McDonnell, who's still in the Labour Party, amazingly. He hasn't said anything too bad, apparently, according to the Witch Hunt Committee. And so here he is talking about various activities of the all part, because he is the spokesperson to the union for all the different parties in Westminster that are trying to make sure that our media stays free.
The NUJ parliamentary group, it's a cross-party group. We work incredibly well together on a cross-party basis, but we would not be effective if it wasn't for Michelle and her team providing the briefings, the detailed research, the interventions that we can make. I'd just like to say thank you on behalf of the group for all that you do to support us, Michelle. Going straight to the report itself, this is the first report in 2 years. It's been a quiet 2 years. It's not often you wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to the NUJ, and then discover the NUJ's removed the chair of the BBC. I could provide you with a list of other people I'd like to secure the sacking of, if you want. On COVID, when COVID occurred, we argued, I was Shadow Chancellor at that point in time, when we argued about the need for a support scheme for workers and protecting their wages and their jobs. We put forward the furlough scheme that eventually was adopted in a form through the negotiations that we had with Sunak when he was Chancellor, and through the TUC negotiations, which the NUJ was a part. But it wasn't all that we wanted. And we were critical when it was produced that it didn't cover the freelance workers in particular, self-employed workers. And it was a huge gap. Something like 2 million people never got the support that we wanted them to. We also wanted a support package for industry. The government did bring an initial emergency support package for print media. But we wanted much more, and we put forward on your behalf the NUJ media recovery plan, arguing with the government itself. The whole argument that we've had year in, year out is about making sure there's an investment in jobs and quality journalism. We've also, during that period as well, obviously supported the industrial disputes that have taken place. In particular, we supported the Reach dispute, and again, everything we've done in Parliament is to highlight the issues in the dispute itself, but also the name and shame, the companies that are refusing to negotiate. And eventually, we can add, I think, some strength to the union's negotiations and pressing. You'll see that we've also taken, as always, the issue of safety of journalists seriously. We've raised the issues with regard to what's happened in Northern Ireland with Tricia Devlin and Martin O'Hagan. But we've also brought forward our concerns about the Online Safety Bill and the threats that are faced by journalists themselves. And we've been, I think, very effective in ensuring some elements of that have been removed, the threat that it had to individual journalists. On the issue of the overall safety, we welcomed and supported the establishment of the government's cross-party national safety committee. And again, what we'll seek to do, working with the union, is any issues arising from that we'll highlight in Parliament itself. Let's just go on the section about journalists in the law. The Police and Crime Censored Courts Act, the new Public Order Bill, they all pose threats to journalists, particularly those covering demonstrations. What we were able to do is raise in Parliament the examples where already journalists have come under attack and prevented from undertaking the role of journalists of reporting the truth and accurately reporting government failure as well. Particularly concerned about what happened to Andy Aitchison about the Napier Barracks report and Charlotte Lynch with regard to the Just Oil protests. Shami Chakrabarti on our behalf raised amendments in the Lords, and we've been relatively successful on that. And again, time and time again, what we've been able to do as a result of the detailed briefing, we're able to speak with authority because it's your members that are telling us what it's like on the ground. We're able, to be frank, to run rings around ministers when they're in the debates themselves, and we've been able to create quite a widespread coalition, both in terms of the Commons and also into the House of Lords as well. The other bills that we're concerned about, obviously the Public Order Bill, we've been able to secure amendments to that already. The government's had to bring forward its own amendments that we promoted to protect journalists. The issue with regard to the National Security Bill, as it stands, it does threaten journalists and whistleblowers in particular. That's coming back to the Commons, and we'll have further discussions to seek to amend that, creating, I think, a quite broad cross-party level of support. The other bills that have produced since this report was drafted, we've got the Draft Media Bill. We'll be having extensive discussions and consultations with the union on that and see what we can secure in terms of, again, the maximum opportunities for yourselves in terms of how we can promote journalism but at the same time protect it as well. The other bill that's been produced now is the Digital Markets and Competition Bill. This is about regulation of digital media overall. We're forming an alliance through the union with other organisations to ensure that we can secure revenues for when journalism and news content is used, and we can secure the proper income for our members. Let's just go again. Sorry, we've also raised time and time again the issue of SLAPs, the strategic lawsuits against public participation. And again, what we've been trying to do is highlight to people just how much this is used now to silence journalists and how we believe we can ensure protection of journalists with appropriate legislation. Time and time again, as you know, we've been raising the issue of Julian Assange, and I think I'm the only MP that's visited him now in Belmarsh, and a number of our members have appeared on many public platforms seeking to prevent his extradition, but also to seek his release too. On public service broadcasting, this is the only time I thought about leaving the country. It was when they appointed Nadine Dorres as Secretary of State for DCMS. No one in their right mind would have ever thought that appointment had taken place. And she exhibited exactly, well, Nadine Dorres, basically. She never knew the issue about how Channel 4 was funded. And there was a real threat in terms of privatisation of Channel 4 if she'd got her way. In addition to that, I think there was a real threat to the BBC licence fee. She's now gone. They've dropped, thanks to your campaign. She's gone, but she hasn't gone far enough. Anyway, they've dropped the proposal. And this is, you should be aware of this. You were at the centre of this campaign to prevent the privatisation of Channel 4. It's an absolutely critical role that you played. But in addition to that, now, obviously, what we're trying to do is raise all these issues with regard to the BBC. You've just had the debate with regard to the digital first strategy, which I think is a real threat, but I think we'll be able to build support to ensure that we get the push the government back on that. And of course, what we've been able to do is support the campaigning with regard to BBC local services as well. We've been on picket lines in the dispute, and we will continue to be on picket lines. But time and time again, we've been raising this issue in Parliament. And it's quite interesting. When we've had Westminster Hall debates, not in the main chamber, but Westminster Hall debates on the BBC local radio services, they are packed out. They're packed out by MPs on all sides. There's a recognition amongst MPs, particularly backbench MPs on all political parties, about the value of BBC local radio services. But unfortunately, that doesn't yet permeate into government. But that's the campaigning that we'll do. finally, with regard to the international campaigning, we've done everything we can to act as a voice of the Union Parliament and pressure on government to protect journalists across the world. That's what we've done from the very existence of our parliamentary group. So we've been raising the issues with regard to Afghanistan. The commitments that were given to include journalists in these schemes to make people safe have been broken time and time again. So we've been raising those issues. It's been scandalous the way the government has acted in really putting people at risk despite all the promises. We've raised the issue of what's happening with regard to Palestinian journalists as well. I attended the commemoration for Shireen Abu Akleh after she was killed by Israeli forces, and we raised the case again 2 weeks ago in Parliament, demanding that this government expresses its view about the way in which Israel, to be frank, murdered that journalist and the way that they should be held to account through the International Criminal Court. We've also raised the concerns with regard to media freedoms and safety of protesters in India. And of course, what we've tried to do is highlight I heard it in the debate earlier, the important role that the BBC World Service plays and the important role that BBC Persian Service in particular plays with regard to Iran. And we've also tried to highlight the oppressive measures that have been taken against journalists in Iran and the role that our government should play in calling that out and pressurising it. Finally, the NUJ is a member of the Trade Union Coordinating Group. It's a group of 11 unions now, I believe. We meet on a regular basis to talk about how unions coordinate their strategy in terms of lobbying Parliament and also in their campaigns. It's proved to be very effective on a number of fronts. The issues, obviously, that are confronting us all now is the EU revocation bill. Some of you will be aware of this. This is the legislation the government has introduced so that all EU legislation drops unless a minister comes forward and brings forward a statutory instrument to keep it in place or amend it in place. What we're worried about is this could be an attack on a large number of trade union rights and employment rights that have been built up through the EU over decades. So we're trying to monitor that as much as we can. But we're talking about something. The government admits to something like 4,800 individual pieces of legislation going through. And the deadline is the end of this year. And if it hasn't gone through, individual NSI protecting a piece of EU legislation hasn't gone through, it falls. So we've intensively working with other trade unions as well as the NUJ to identify where we're at with regard to those individual pieces of legislation. The other issue, obviously, is the minimum services guarantee bill that's going through, which is to inflict upon trade unions that within certain sectors, and I think those sectors will creep as a result of the way the government's going, certain sectors, a minimum service has to be guaranteed. The employer will decide what that minimum service is. The employer will decide which workers have to come in. All rights to protection against dismissal are gone for that worker if they refuse to come in, and the trade union has to enforce that or they'll be fined. This is draconian legislation, and obviously as a union we'll be linking with others to lobby and campaign against it. I'm fearful that this government, as a result of this wave of industrial action that's taken, is becoming more reactionary by the day, and it's evidenced in the legislation that we're facing. But as a union, through the parliamentary group, we'll link up with other unions in Parliament and do all we can to confront the government on this, and all we can, not just to ameliorate the legislation, but defeat it. Thanks, Chair.
Pretty comprehensive report from John McDonnell, Martin. Most importantly, possibly, is this National Security Act. This is something which is chugging down through the pipelines. The implications, bill, as it is at the moment, there are all sorts of complaints about it. I'm not sure what you know about it, but there's also the online safety bill, they call it, which is going to basically put the onus on the tech giants like Facebook and the rest of them to do the regulation. So they are the ones who will decide what posts stay there and what don't. And if they get it wrong, they'll get multi-million pound fines. So it seems that the government is just, I mean, this is one of the things we were chatting about in the conference, is the government is simply going to be standing back from all of this and letting the Facebooks and the tech giants regulate themselves.
Well, they pretty much do that already, don't they, in collusion with the intelligence services.
Well, worth noting, of course, that when the RT, et cetera, were booted off the airwaves, it was the big satellite channels that switched them off. A few days later, Ofcom came out with a judgment. So in a way, I mean, we're living in the kind of corporatist world where the democratic actors don't play a part in any way.
Well, I think there's always been differential access to media. And the powers that be, the wealthy and well-connected, have always had much better platforms than anybody else. And, of course, they're determined to keep control of that going forward, as, you know, we are effectively at war with Russia. And therefore, they feel that their mentality is that they need to control the narrative and fill people's minds with what is essentially disinformation. And at the same time, they then pretend that they're protecting the population from disinformation. It's Orwellian, and we're already there, really.
I mean, it does seem as if this is a bit accelerationist, dark enlightenment, Nick Land here. The idea being that the technology is far more important than the people that are using it.
Well, the technology creates the possibility for social manipulation, doesn't it? It's the nature of the technology, and it's quite likely that the design of the internet was created within the deep state in the US. It was going to happen anyway, but they made sure it happened in a way way they wanted it to happen. It would never have developed with just private sector investment. It required the Pentagon to invest in it. That's where the internet came from, and they've used it ruthlessly. For example, in color revolutions in Egypt and elsewhere. What's beginning to happen is, as the technology diffuses around the world, is that governments who are being attacked are getting more savvy about dealing with the kind of things that the Western intelligence services do using social media. But they're obviously determined to control social media in such a way as that people feel as if they're communicating freely and getting free information, but in actual fact, it's a very narrow band of information that they're getting, and certain things just don't get through. Obvious one to point out is the bombing of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Everybody else in the whole world, I spoke to people in South Africa, Latin America, they all know what happened.
But those that watch the mainstream press,
yes,
don't
you're know. Watching mainstream media in Britain. Most people are just blissfully unaware.
Or in South Africa, probably.
Most people wouldn't know that it had been blown up, even though it's absolutely crucial to explain the cost of living crisis. They, A, wouldn't know it had been blown up, and B, if they did know it had been blown up, they wouldn't know that Seymour Hersh has uncovered that it was the Americans that did it.
Well, anyway, look, let's just look at the online safety bill for a minute. Technology companies offering encrypted messaging services have urged the government to make urgent changes to legislation going through Parliament, threatens to undermine the privacy of encrypted communications. In an open letter, WhatsApp, Signal, Threema, THREMA, not heard of them, and other encrypted messaging services have called for the UK government to rethink measures in the online safety bill that will weaken the security of encrypted communications around the world. The National Union of Journalists, which represents journalists in the UK, also warned the bill would undermine the safety of communications between journalists and their confidential sources. The online safety bill, which is beginning its committee stage in the House of Lords this week or last week, 19th of April, actually, it started, so that's a week before, faces a number of amendments from peers who've raised concerns about aspects of the legislation. So the idea is that the state wants to be able to snoop in on everything, basically, including encrypted communication. The thing is that this is something which they no longer really need to go to court to get warrants for, Martin. The idea is it's there for GCHQ or whoever, NSA, to just look at any time they fancy.
Well, I think what they're doing here is pretty much what they did with the, you know, putting the police, military and intelligence services beyond the law. It's basically an ex post facto justification of what they're doing already. So they're putting this legislation in to tidy up the fact that they're already, they do, in fact, look at everybody's stuff. But this now makes it official that they will be allowed to, or they've been doing it anyway, even when in theory they weren't allowed to.
Well, the big battle at the National Union of Journalists conference is actually nothing to do with that. It's about subs, as usual, about whether to, because of the increasing inflation rate. But just one basic thing about inflation, Martin. We've had interest rates being put up to keep inflation down. Now, that seems to me to be very counterintuitive. The idea is that if you're putting interest rates up, that anyone that's got a loan is going to have to put their prices up, not down, in order to keep their business viable.
Well, it is true that if you raise interest rates, it does things like raising mortgage rates, which then mean people, you know, that isn't actually part of the RPI measure. It ought to be, because housing cost is fundamental.
Well, of course, it should be, yeah. But, I mean, it just seems to me as if there's a basic lack of – I mean, it's not counterintuitive. It's just wrong.
Well,
if
no,
you put up interest rates
– Right,
if you
are
Martin,
right.
Hang on, just let me finish the sentence. If you put up interest rates, that is going to increase inflation, surely.
Well, In some areas it will, as I just mentioned, mortgages there. But in actual fact, raising interest rates means that, as you say, businesses will not necessarily be able to pass on their costs to consumers. Depends what their cost base is and what their market power is. Ultimately, the raising of interest rates is in order to get rid of zombie businesses or weak businesses, in theory, just getting rid of the weak ones. The danger is, of course, that you just crash the whole economy. This is the catch-22 situation that central banks have now got themselves into. In order to control inflation, they've only got one tool, interest rates. There are other mechanisms, by the way. We could talk about those. But if you've only got interest rates, you've got to raise interest rates. But at that point, you run the risk of crashing the whole economy. And well, it's quite likely that they will.
During the pandemic?
Bring inflation down in the initial phases.
A lot of companies went out of business during the pandemic. Could it be that actually many of these markets are now fixed markets with people being able to do price fixing? They can just, I mean, so for example, obviously as the energy companies have done, they say, oh, we're going to increase our prices 40, 50, 60, 100%, and there's nothing anyone can do about it.
Well, that's right, because the commanding heights of the economy are oligopolized, and therefore they are in a position to pass on price increases as cost increases, and in any case, as what's being classified as greedflation, where because of inflation, they feel they can get away with rising their prices, even though their costs haven't risen. So they're actually increasing their profits. Unite have a report that's come out this week about the profits being made by privatised utilities, amongst others, in this situation. And of course, what the answer to that is to have nationalised industries and price controls. But of course, we don't do any of that. Since the 1980s, you can't have nationalised industries, you can't have price controls, so we've got to raise the interest rates.
Yeah, but yes,
which means,
can.
Of course, that you're putting loads of business out of work.
We've got to have those things. We've got to have a mixed economy. I mean, wasn't it around about one third of the economy back in the 1970s?
Was it
a half of the economy then, which was public sector?
At least half the economy. As it is now, indirectly, it just goes to private sector suppliers instead of to the government's own, infrastructure. We're too far gone on this now, Tony. The financialisation of particularly the British economy has reached an almost saturation point. And when the financial markets collapse, Britain is going to suffer disproportionately because we don't do anything else. That's all we do is property bubbles. We don't do anything else anymore. Russia has got Russia has got massive resources. They've got all sorts of technologically advanced industries, space, they put rockets into space, etc. We don't do any of that, so we will suffer disproportionately.
Anyway, luckily, of course, we've got a Majesty's opposition who are fighting back in order to renationalise, or are they? Because another one of the Corbynite or Corbynista MPs, Diane Abbott, suspended this week as a Labour MP, pending an investigation into a letter. Now, of course, we know what that means. That means she's out for good, because these pending things never seem to actually be properly looked at or dealt with in any way. In her letter, she said many types of white people with points of difference can experience prejudice, in a letter published on Sunday, but they are not subject to racism all their lives, she said. She's in the letter, she wrote that Irish, Jewish and traveller people undoubtedly experience prejudice, which she said is similar to racism. She continued, it's true that many types of white people with points of difference, such as redheads, can experience this prejudice, but they are not all their lives subject to racism. So what do you make of her letter, Martin? I'm assuming you've had a look at it. Well, is it right that she's been suspended from the Labour Party now?
Well, I think politically it was unwise of her to open this can of worms. There's all sorts of debates that might be had about who's more discriminated against and who's less discriminated against. Far more discrimination against Muslims, for example, than against Jews. I don't think there's very much doubt about that.
I mean, what problem can the Labour Party have with her comments?
She was foolish. She was foolish to get involved in this discussion, because it's going to give the right wing the chance to get rid of her.
Well, that's right. And this is what, chatting to delegates here, you know, they were saying, well, you know, in the climate of the witch hunt, she's walked straight into it. But maybe she's thinking, well, what the hell? I want to get this out there and I want to say it anyway.
Well, she's already apologised for saying it. So if that was a strategy...
She's done very little. I mean, I've seen no proper statement from her anywhere. So she seems to be sort of hiding under a rock now, which is, I think, very unwise. She should get out there and, you know, be absolutely clear about what she really thinks. And, you know, the idea really here is that a lot of people in the Labour Party are afraid to say what they really think, Martin. That means it's not very good for debate. It's not a broad church anymore, is it?
Well, that's true. But I still think she was unwise to take the line that she did. Not that, you know, it's worth discussing, but in the current situation, she's opening herself up to attack. Now, that's not necessarily fair. Attacks on her are not necessarily motivated.
So, do you think it's right to suspend her? Were they right to suspend her?
Well, they have suspended her. It's not really my decision whether they suspend her or not, Tony. And I suspect, as you say, that she will not be allowed to stand at the next election for the Labour Party. That causes a problem for Labour activists like me, because if Jeremy Corbyn stands as an independent in Islington, then we can remain members of the Labour Party in good standing and campaign for other Labour candidates. I think it's unlikely that Diane Abbott will do that. I think if she is expelled, she'll just stand down.
Yeah, but look, the more people that Starmer does this to,
service over many years.
Martin, the more people that Starmer does this to, particularly the Corbynistas, the more likely it is that they will start to form their own little alliance in Parliament and outside Parliament, isn't it?
Yes, except we've already
got a new party.
Chris Williamson has already joined the Socialist Labour Party. And, of course, that's what will happen. But that, under first past the post, and, of course, Starmer has made no indication of changing the electoral system whatsoever. Under first past the post, they will never be able to get anybody elected, apart from in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, of course, where they do have PR for local elections.
Well, one of the commentators on this, I think, is excellent, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is good old Tony Greenstein, who, by the way, this week is facing jail for allegedly trying to shut down or at least campaign against an Israeli arms firm called Elbit, I think up in Wolverhampton, somewhere like that. But anyway, we'll see next week how Tony gets on and what his sentence is. Whether he's found guilty, not guilty, etc. But he's written something on his blog this week. One thing Diane Abbott hasn't been suspended for is anti-Semitism, he says. There is no doubt Diane Abbott's letter could have been better worded. Pigmentation or colour isn't the cause of racism, though in Britain it's because of our colonial heritage. Being black and victims of racism are synonymous. By racism I mean institutionalised and state racism, not prejudice. But nothing in her letter was any way racist or anti-Semitic. It's all those who are calling for Diane's expulsion, such as the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the Jewish Chronicle, who are the most virulent racists, he says. They give unqualified support for the world's only apartheid state, that is Israel. It was only last week the Jewish Chronicle leader stated there is no context to the murder of the D's, referring to the killing of three British settlers in the West Bank. They alleged the settlers were killed because they were Jewish rather than because they were settlers. The context they denied was the murder of 95 Palestinians, including 17 children by Israel, in the first quarter of this year, Martin.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, the reality is that racism is endemic, and it can be practiced by anybody, towards anybody. And, of course, the Israeli state is an explicitly racist state.
Well, Tony,
why it should have boycotts, sanctions and disinvestment imposed on it as South Africa did back in the day. And many people in South Africa would agree with that. But, of course, to call for that is now recalled anti-Semitism. That is not anti-Semitism. And Tony Greenstein is absolutely right to say that. You know, the state of Israel is itself racist, and therefore calls to boycott it are not racist in any way, shape or form. And you could argue that what Diane Abbott said, as she pointed out, is badly worded, badly phrased. But in a fairer setup, they'd probably just say, OK, that's just their opinion.
Tony Greenstein goes further. He says there's nothing anti-Semitic about saying today's Jews are a privileged section of white British society and that they are not victims of racism as opposed to prejudice. The real reason for Diane Abbott's suspension lies in the determination of Keir Starmer to remove the last vestiges of the Labour left in Parliament whilst emphasising his support for the, in brackets, anti-Semitism weapon which the British state wields against supporters of the Palestinians. If Starmer were genuinely concerned about racism, then Neil Coyle, the right-wing Labour MP who was suspended for 5 days for abusing a British Chinese journalist, Henry Dyer, and also abusing a parliamentary assistant to another MP, he would have had the whip restored. Nor would Trevor Phillips, the racist broadcaster who believes Muslims are a nation within a nation, have been reinstated into the Labour Party. Diane Abbott, on the other hand, has been the subject of more racist abuse, he says, than any other MP. The organisation which is responsible for combating anti-Semitism is something called the Community Security Trust, and he has lots of photographs here of this organisation, CST, with these various Star of David and the Israeli flag behind Starmer and these people from the CST. And he says that's a project of Israel's Mossad, the Community Security Trust, Martin. Have you ever heard of them?
Yes, I have, yeah. Well, yes. I mean, all of this is fair comment by Tony Greenstein, isn't it? Who was himself expelled from the Labour Party for anti-Semitism, even though he's Jewish and his father was a rabbi. You can see what a mess this is turning into. All I would criticise Diane Abbott for is being unwise in saying what she said at this particular time, because she's opened up herself to attack. She doesn't deserve to be attacked, but it's very hard to see how she's going to be able to defend herself in the current climate. And if she does have to resign from politics, I think she should also be commended for all of the struggles she's put up over many, many years. She's probably taken, as Tony says, more abuse than any other politician. She's borne it all with very broad shoulders and great good humour. And it's sad to see her career end in this way, if that's what it turns out to be.
Yeah, it looks like it probably will be. Yeah, as many others who tell the truth, honest people seem to get skewered by Mr. Starmer. In a way, it would have been kind of nice to see Jeremy Corbyn doing the same to some of his opponents, but no, and he left it far too late. But anyway, it's not just the Labour Party which is skewering its MPs, it's also the Conservatives. Andrew Bridgen this week, MP, has been expelled from the Conservative Party, and he had this to say about it.
It's deeply upsetting to be expelled from a party I've served for several decades and campaigned hard for, but I barely recognise the Conservative Party at the moment. We seem to have moved away from being a party that legislates for the people to a party that legislates against the people. Surely I've got the right to free speech, to express the genuine and legitimate concerns of my constituents about the safety and efficacy of experimental vaccines which were never tested properly. We know there's considerable vaccine harms. They're starting to emerge now. And Patrick, before I spoke out in December, and what urged me to do so was when the government were looking at approving the experimental vaccines for children down to the age of 6 months, to babies. As a result of those speeches I gave in Parliament, the government position has moved in a few months from wanting to vaccinate babies of 6 months, that never happened, then they moved the position to only over 50s and the immunocompromised in January, for February the 12th. I gave another speech on the 17th of March pointing out how the boosters were the lack of efficacy and the cost of them and the dangers of them. And then it's moved to over 75s, a completely different position that the government were adopting. And I put it to you, there was no one else speaking out. And if that's cost me my political career, then so be it, quite honestly, Patrick, because if I've saved the life or one child from being injured, that's worth it, isn't it?
Well, what would you say to people, Andrew, who would say that maybe you've overplayed the harms of the vaccines and that maybe you have overstated how experimental they were or how much potential damage that they could cause for people, that basically you've gone a bit OTT?
Well, let's debate it then, Patrick. But every time I get stand up to speak, the Chamber of the House of Commons empties. They put up ministers who aren't even qualified to in the area of specialisation. The last two speeches I've given, we've had a minister who wasn't even the minister to respond to that question. This is not open and free democracy. You know that there's a narrative out there, and if you go against the narrative that the vaccines are safe and effective, which they're not, you get closed down. I'm banned from the... From the 13th of December, when I stood up in the House of Commons and said that the vaccines, we needed to investigate, I've been basically cancelled from the mainstream media.
Hmm. I'm just going to come in and say, you're perfectly entitled to your view, of course you are, and that is that. At the same time, would you accept that the vaccines did save lives, though? Would you accept that?
I don't see that the evidence is out there that would support that the risk from the vaccine didn't outweigh the benefits to all age groups in the data that I've presented to the House of Commons. Even the most vulnerable, the over 70s, at the best case scenario, they needed 800 boosters to keep one person out of hospital, not acutely out of hospital, whereas one in 800 is at least the average for a severe adverse reaction from the boosters themselves. So there was no benefit even to the most vulnerable group in society. And I explained all that to the Chamber and the House on the 17th of March. No one's been able to rebut those figures because they are scientifically evidenced.
I get what you're saying.
When all this is investigated, Patrick, if it's investigated independently, I'm afraid, and I really wish I wasn't.
Well, I wish I was wrong,
but I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, look, you obviously know, Andrew, don't you, that the World Health Organization and a lot of other scientists and doctors would come out and massively dispute what you've said there. And so I suppose I do kind of have to ask, why do you think you're right and they're not?
Because all the people who say that they're safe and effective on the science and medical side have got a financial interest. You know, 86% of the funding of the Medicines and Healthcare Product Regulatory Agency is from Big Pharma. The Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, the members of that committee, who are supposed to look at the efficacy and safety of vaccines, they had to declare over £1 billion of personal interest in Big Pharma. Our regulators are compromised, Patrick. The people who are
Is that true? They haven't got a pecuniary interest.
Those are the figures. Go and check them up for yourself. And who do you think funds the WHO? The biggest funder to the WHO is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Gavi, both controlled by Bill Gates, who you might remember made an awful lot of money out of mRNA vaccines.
Look, it would obviously, as I'm sure you can understand, Andrew, it goes without saying that many people would dispute the fact that they were compromised, etc. That's your view. They would have a different view. They would dispute that. Why do you feel so passionately about this? This is, let's be honest with you, the hill you have chosen to die on. You could have had a perfectly comfortable gig, no doubt, in the House of Commons until the people of North West Leicestershire decide that they've had enough of you. Why did you decide to, for want of a better phrase, die on this hill?
Because this is about the safety and the health and well-being of children, and when the government... certainly young people are at no risk of dying from COVID-19, but there's a clear risk from the vaccine. It doesn't make scientific sense to expose people. You know, the first rule of medicine is do no harm. Sajid Javid was advised by... There are a number of doctors who are Conservative MPs. I know that he was advised, when he took over from Matt Hancock, not to authorise the experimental vaccines for anyone under 18. He listened to that advice, but he didn't take it, and he authorised them. That was a huge mistake, Patrick. The harms that have been done are not rare. They're common. They're at least one in 800, and it could be down to one in 300, a severe adverse event. That's why we've got excess deaths. Another issue we can't debate in Parliament, no matter how many times I ask for it, you know, there's 1,000, 2,000 excess deaths a week in this country, and Parliament does not want to debate it. I mean, this just isn't right. I think anybody who challenges the official narrative on anything is now under pressure. That is not free speech, and it's certainly not democracy. I would ask you to have a look at the list of MPs who voted against the government and voted against Plan B in Christmas 21, December 21. I was one of those. I've looked at that list of Conservative MPs who voted against the government about the masks, the mandates on the NHS, and the additional lockdowns, which were all proven to be unnecessary because of the Omicron variant. Look how many of those have either been suspended or attacked by our own party. That's quite considerable. That's what it's all about. I spoke out a long time ago about these measures. The whole pandemic response has led to a huge amount of problems, unnecessary damage to our economy, to the well-being of young people and their mental health, and it's still going on. And until we admit we've made mistakes, the government's made mistakes, we're not going to put anything right. We certainly shouldn't be giving any more powers to the WHO to take over our laws and the administration of pandemics. They've got an appalling track record, and we should be steering well clear of any of that. It's the absolute antithesis of Brexit, taking back control.
So that's the expelled from the Tory party MP, Andrew Bridgen, speaking there earlier this week, I think, to Patrick Christie on GB News. Martin, he's all sorts of things to talk about from that, but his main, he's saying essentially that the government, the present government, is far more interested in Big Pharma than it is in the health and safety of people. I mean, you might actually think, well, that's exactly what they're doing with the National Health Service too, running it down, running it into the ground. And we've also got this court case coming along I was hearing about yesterday, which is AstraZeneca. A lot of victims of the AstraZeneca jabs are now coming to take money off the government through the courts, saying, well, look, I want large amounts of compensation for my loved one that was killed by the AstraZeneca jab. So that may be one of the reasons why the government really doesn't want to listen to people like Andrew Bridgen.
Well, no. Obviously, Big Pharma have a huge influence. They fund political parties. They control things, and the obvious socialist answer to that is have it all nationalised. I wonder if Andrew Bridgen would be in favour of that nowadays. It would be interesting to see. I've got sympathy with his views about vaccines. They certainly were rushed out without proper testing. The reason being, and people were told at the time, is because we want to get the economy moving. The only way to get the economy moving is to get everybody jabbed up. I don't agree with his views on lockdowns and masks. And of course, that then leads to a situation where I might discount his views on vaccines. But that would be silly because they're all separate issues. And, you know, people should be adult enough to distinguish between different, different issues and what the relationship between the different things is. And of course, he certainly hasn't mentioned that it's a biowarfare attack by the US deep state on China, according to, you know, this now becoming increasingly clear. And the sort of debates we had during the COVID pandemic, it was a pandemic, and now we're moving on to the next phase of World War III, which won't necessarily be biological. It's going to be something else.
Yes, I think you might be right there, especially since this week the British Ministry of Defence admitted, yes, they have been sending depleted uranium shells lovely gifts to the Ukrainian people who they love so much. But look, before the break, we're going to hear a little bit about the coronation. Well, this is author John Morgan, who I spoke to several years ago. I think this is another interview, though, that he did with somebody else, talking about the death of Princess Diana. There's so much to say about this, really, particularly Noel Botham's book and John Morgan's books, both about the death of Diana, which really do go into the detail about how the poor woman was murdered, really, for being, well, assassinated, I think, because she was a political figure, for campaigning against landmines, for marrying a Muslim, for being pregnant potentially with a Muslim child who'd have been a half-brother for William and Harry, and also being far, far better at using the press and coming across extremely well in the press, much, much better, of course, than the then Prince, now King Charles. So do you think anyone will be whispering the words Diana during the coronation, Martin?
Well, I'm sure you're going to be shouting from the back, Tony. Won't be just whispers. I mean, the monarchy, which we regularly discuss on this show, is what it is. It's a huge multi-billion pound organisation, and it's going to dominate everything for the next 10 days, as it does quite frequently.
Well, I think one of the things maybe we should be playing on this show, maybe I'll see if I can dig it out for next week, is the Camilla Gate tapes, which were a response to, there was some, I think it was probably MI5 in conjunction with The Sun, listening into conversations that Diana was having with one of her lovers, and also to conversations between, the second one that came out was the one between Charles and Camilla, which talked about Charles wanting to be reincarnated as a tampon, and various other little jokes, which I think in a way is a bit unfair, but I think we should certainly be really listening to those. Noel Botham's book, The Murder of Princess Diana, is extremely comprehensive. He talks about things like her ruptured, what they said was a blood test, showing that she was pregnant. That was also gotten rid of. Charles, William and Harry were up at a shooting lodge in Balmoral, apparently. There was a sort of little conclave going on up there. There was also the pregnancy as a motive was apparently suppressed too. Lots and lots of information in his book. Just to run through a couple of other things, there was a bright flash scene in the tunnel. I'm not sure if that was Henri Paul flashing his headlights or something, but may well not have been. The Mercedes engine was racing at a very high speed when the car had actually crashed, which does suggest potentially that there was some sort of interference making it accelerate, maybe through hacking or some other means. Apparently the brakes didn't work. It was found, one of the investigators into the car. All sorts of questions about it. The MI6 Paris station, Richard Tomlinson testifying that he had seen a plot to kill Slobodan Milosevic, which was identical to the what happened to Princess Diana, which was her high-speed car chase and a crash in a tunnel. And with the person then dying, if they didn't die in the tunnel, they would be made to die on the way to the hospital. All sorts of stuff in that, and that is, yeah, so it's that book is, I'll put a link up to that on our show page. There are a couple of really good books on Diana: The Murder of Princess Diana, Revealed, The Truth Behind the Assassination of the Century by Noel Botham. So let's have a listen now to another one of the writers, that's John Morgan, before we go into the break, where he talks about this Prince Charles, as he was at the Times, group called the Way Ahead Group, where Charles's private secretary at the time was trying to deal with the whole situation of Diana and deciding what to do about her increasing positive publicity that she was getting and negative effect on the royal family.
I was just talking about the Way Ahead Group, which is the royal family's committee that deals with major policy and issues facing the royal family. And we were talking about in July 1997 how the Way Ahead Group meeting was brought forward. And what happened was, when you look at the dates of what occurred where Diana took the two boys away on the holiday to Muhammad's Villa in the south of France. And you look at the dates of the Way Ahead Group meetings, there was actually a preparatory meeting held on July the 8th, which is another reason why you would see the purpose of Way Ahead Group meetings as being much more than dealing with scheduling, which is what the private secretary said, because if you have a preparatory meeting, then you have a full meeting later, and which is what happened in July 1997. So, if there was just dealing with scheduling, it would be dealt with by the private secretaries. You wouldn't have the Queen and Philip and that being there in the meetings. You would have the private secretaries discussing things, going back to their principals and working it out between themselves. So anyway, that's by the by. But what they did is on the July the 8th, 1997, there was a preparatory meeting of the Way Ahead Group, and that was 3 days before Diana took the boys on the holiday. So the holiday started on July the 11th, and then the holiday finished on July the 20th, and then the Way Ahead Group meeting occurred on July the 23rd. The main full meeting occurred on July the 23rd, which was 3 days after the boys were back at, this is up at Balmoral, where the Royals go for holidays at that time of the year. And so the boys were returned to, returned to Balmoral on July the 20th, and the Way Ahead Group meeting took place on July the 23rd. And actually, it's interesting because on July the 20th, there was an article in, I think it was the Sunday Mirror in the UK, where they were talking about the upcoming Way Ahead Group meeting, and they said Diana will be top of the agenda. So there was a leak to the media from someone in the royal household that told this reporter that Diana would be top of the agenda, but it basically ties in with the holiday that she took the boys on, which would have been a huge issue for the Royals, taking the future king.
So
the reasons that she would have been assassinated, and you know, like I said, well, it's more what she was going to do, but she'd already done a lot, you know. But the what happened was, after the holiday, when she took the boys to Muhammad's, then immediately after that, the relationship with Dodi developed. So even in those 3 days between the holiday in the south of France and the Way Ahead Group meeting that actually took place on July the 23rd, even in those 3 days, that relationship with Dodi was starting, and she was under surveillance by MI6, and so that information about the developing relationship even would have been known to the Royals. Plus, William and Harry had been there when Diana and Dodi met as well at the villa. So you sort of the relationship of Dodi developed, and Diana, even before that, was planning to move to the US, so she would have been getting even further out of the Queen's orbit, more out of control, you know. So there was a build-up of factors there, and with the Diana-Dodi relationship, of course, you've got the potential for a Muslim to be the stepfather to the king, which is basically not acceptable as well. So that's a reason why she would be assassinated. That relationship was really moving quite quickly, actually, and there was an engagement ring that was purchased. They were about to get engaged. That's what the evidence points to, that when Diana died, they were about to get engaged, and so that would have been a pressure, the building pressure as well, you know. But when you're looking at the motives, it's, you know, I think the decision was made that she would be removed, assassinated. That decision was made somewhere in that late July area. So about a month before she actually died.
Well, that's John Morgan, who's passed away now, but his words live on. His book, How They Murdered Princess Diana, is not some nut job book. It's transcripts from the police investigations, from the French police and from the British police, and also a lot is taken directly from the transcripts of the inquest into her death, which there were, I think, it was finally the fourth coroner that actually agreed to do the inquest. And, of course, the verdict was unlawful killing. Finally, sorry, Martin, I forgot to ask you about the teaching. Unless you've got anything to say about Diana.
Well, not really. I mean, all of this stuff has been in the public domain for quite a long time, and there's clearly something going on there.
So what about you were on strike on Thursday?
Yeah, well, I'm a member of the National Education Union, so I was on strike on Thursday. What's happened with that is that the government did come up with an increased payoff of well below the rate of inflation, and certainly nothing like going to put teachers back on the level of pay they had before austerity began after 2008. But they said even that limited pay offer would have to be funded out of the existing school budgets. And 98% of NEU members who balloted against accepting the deal. Because, of course, if teachers were to accept that deal, they're not going to, but if they did accept that deal, you'd be put in the invidious position of parents saying, well, we haven't got extra books and we're running out of equipment because of your pay increase. Mm. And teachers are just not going to accept that. The pay increase has to be funded by central government so that school budgets are unaffected. Otherwise, it isn't a pay increase.
Well, that's right. I mean, just, I was passing a school at the weekend, and I couldn't quite believe it. There were some of the parents and a couple of teachers and the head sitting out making cups of coffee for people and trying to raise funds to keep the upkeep of the school by shaking tins outside the school as people were going to the shops.
Well, that's right. I mean, this dispute isn't primarily actually about wages. It's about the underfunding of education over a long period, and the fact that we don't have enough people to do the jobs that need to be done. And schools don't have the budgets they need to deal with the problems.
I think that's one of the main reasons for all of these strikes at the moment in the public sector is the people who are working there, as you are, Martin, can see the hemorrhaging of talent and ability and staff and trained people because they're finding it very difficult to make a living in that profession anymore, and they're deciding to switch jobs.
Yeah, well, there's a differential between private sector pay and public sector pay. And if you don't keep public sector pay in line with private sector pay for similar jobs. I mean, some private sector pay is, public sector jobs tend to be more skilled, actually. Not all of them, but most of them more skilled. And therefore, people say, well, the pay in the private sector is lower, but it's lower for lower level of work. Yeah. So, and if you don't keep that balance between public and private sector pay, then what happens is the public sector loses key staff, which is why we haven't got enough nurses, doctors and teachers, certainly maths teachers, as Sunak keeps going on about. If you want good maths teachers, you've got to pay them salaries which are equivalent to what they could get in the private sector with a maths degree. And that's, they're nowhere near. So, and if you say, well, it's quite a cushy job anyway, being a teacher, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's why everybody's leaving the profession, because it's so cushy.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course, it's not cushy, in fact. It's quite.
Well, I think you make it. You make
and,
that
and people don't want to do it if they're not properly rewarded.
Yeah, it's so cushy. Why is everyone leaving? Exactly. I mean, you're getting this in journalism too, where journalists ask to stay late in the evening when they're not even being paid to do it. You're getting a lot of, a lot of work spreading out from schools into, once you get home, it's almost like homework that the teachers have got to do. Anyway, look, we're going to be looking at the debate. We're going to be hearing the debate, the exclusive, amazing debate, I think, anyway, between the National Union of Mine Workers and Extinction Rebellion after some music.
Hand in the hand of the man who steals the world.
Well, it's funny how things work. Back in, well, a bit about 1976, a certain Nick Land, the father of accelerationism, said, oh, you really ought to have a listen to this. He had the double album of it, Electric Ladyland, by Jimi Hendrix. And I took it home and had a listen. Wow, that's great. I love that. So along with Made in Japan by Deep Purple, that's, I think, the second Nick Land recommendation used on this program. So there you go. That was from 1968. Moon Turned the Tides Gently Away, from Electric Ladyland, as I said, Jimi Hendrix. And before that, it was Ocean from 1971, Put Your Hand in the Hand. So Martin, the climate debate we're going to hear now, I would be really interested to hear, just before we start, your take on this whole idea of Extinction Rebellion, their agenda and their complete hatred of coal versus what you and I grew up with, which was the support for the miners, the National Union of Mine Workers.
Well, I'm not a big fan of Extinction Rebellion, as you're probably aware. But if you did decide that you were going to run down the coal industry, and the issue back in the day was whether it was profitable or not. And some of it was and some of it wasn't. But the whole lot was closed down by the government because they wanted to get rid of the trade unions and the power that they had, including the power potentially to bring down governments as they did in 1972 and 1974. But whatever you're going to do going forward, you've got to have a plan to do it. You can't just switch it all off. China, for example, is increasing coal-burning power stations because they've got a growing economy and they've got to get energy from somewhere. They're also massively investing in things like solar energy and so on. So it's not an either-or thing.
No, but I mean, it's bizarre, isn't it? It's almost like this so-called left-wing group, Extinction Rebellion, have picked up where Thatcher left off. Anyway, let's have a listen now to... this is quite a long excerpt from it because it's, I think, absolutely fascinating. I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And hopefully on the weekend we'll have the video up, carefully edited by Dave Bazenko. But not just a sound engineer, obviously a vision engineer too. So this is Shane Collins from XR and David Douglas from the National Union of Mine Workers on the zero carbon coal UK climate, energy and transport policy debate.
It was called the Don Valley Scheme, right? And it was Richard Budge's green energy. They applied for the grant. As I say, the Europeans called it the greatest carbon reduction scheme in the world. The Chinese and the Indians said they would allow that technology to be built in their countries to reduce their carbon. I mean, had it been done, it would have solved the whole problem of China's carbon emissions within about 5 years, that length of time it took you to build the plant.
Okay, well, let's Shane, do you want to just come in?
You can get my book. And you've got email address and you've got a picture of the book.
This is not sort of traditionally what we call carbon capture and storage, is it?
Well, some people talk about sucking the carbon out of the air. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about sucking general carbon out of the air, which I think incidentally is very dangerous because how much carbon do you want to suck out of the air? Live without carbon.
Okay, so carbon... people can look it up in your book or else they can up what we've just been talking about if they want to go into that further. I'd like to just look at the principle of, I mean, for many people right now, they are against a lot of these climate measures simply because it seems to have been involved in massively pushing up the price of energy. I mean, there's been a rather crude attempt to blame this all on Russia, but I think most people can see that the energy prices have been rising for all sorts of other reasons. And we're being told, particularly with gas and electricity, that's the actual reason for it. So, Shane, do you just want to say something about, because, you know, what would you say to someone that says, we're fed up with these Greens because the results of their lobbying is massively increasing our energy costs?
That's the line that Tufton Street takes, that the carbon, you know, that Policy Exchange takes, that all these think tanks based around Tufton Street who are opaquely funded by dodgy American, you know, Koch brothers or fossil fuel companies. Look, renewables are cheaper to produce than coal, nuclear, certainly oil. I'm pretty sure. Nuclear, once you've built the turbine or the solar panel, your marginal costs are very, very low indeed. So, you know, renewables are far cheaper than gas. The reason gas is so expensive is after the pandemic, China and Asia, you know, had a vast economic revival. Everybody wanted gas, and the price spiked. And then with the war in Ukraine, it was the traders in the market that pushed up the price of gas. You know, the world was still producing about the same amount. But the traders use that as an excuse. So, there may be trouble ahead. Let's put the future price of gas up. But, you know, I absolutely repeat, renewables are cheaper than fossil fuels now.
Okay, and David, I don't think you agree with that, do you?
Renewables that are pushing up the price of electricity.
I absolutely refute it. It's like being in a horse race and nobbling the other horses in the race and saying your horse has won. You closed down all of the coal mines, which was producing power at £35 per megawatt hour at a time when nuclear was 92 and wind offshore was £200 a megawatt hour and £150 onshore. Now,
yeah, but now
you've got rid of. Now you've got rid of the coal. We were supplying it for £36 from Hatfield a ton to Drax Power Station. Having closed down all the coal mines, it's now £280 a ton imported from the United States. Not that they use it for power generation very much in Britain, very little, about 1 or 2%, just to keep it ticking over. But the fact is, the reason why the coal's gone up in price is because you closed the coal mines. And the reason why wind is purported to be cheaper is because, first of all, 2/3 of all of our power bills go towards the renewables.
2/3?
25%.
No. Sorry, David, that is absolutely not true. You're trying to say
25% of the standard charge goes to the power bills. There's a 33% charge on all fossil fuel, which goes to the wind turbines in order to subsidize them. It's subsidized at every single level. If it had to stand on its own feet, it would be about 100. It would be dearer than nuclear.
Well, hang on, David, because surely, you know, the justification is that these new technologies need that subsidy to get going.
Well, I don't care. As long as you don't say it's cheaper, it's not cheaper. It's cheaper because it's subsidized. 2/3 of the electricity bill goes to renewables. They supply 40% of electricity. Another 40% is supplied by gas, which it shouldn't be doing. That should be clean coal.
Now, you mentioned the Drax power station. Can you say something about that? Because I've looked at some of the short documentaries and things on Drax, and I'm quite concerned, David, that it was one of the biggest coal-fired power stations in the country, and there is still a section of it. It is there's still a section of it which is able to burn coal when the power grid desperately needs it. But as I understand it, this is now being used to burn trees.
This was another green victory, because the Greens lobbied and stamped and spat that dummy out over wanting biofuels, which they thought was the great salvation. Biofuels was just a bloody nickname for burning trees. So now, nearly all the trees that are burned in the world are burnt in Drax, and they're turned into wood pellets, put onto trains, put onto ships, transported halfway across the world. They're running trains from Immingham and from the ports through the closed mining communities into the power station to burn in the power station instead of coal, producing more CO2 than the bloody coal did.
Jane, what do you make of this? I mean, because there was a film, wasn't there, Michael Moore film, Planet of the Humans, yes, which pointed out, yes, that one of the solutions to the climate crisis was to burn these wood chips, which, I mean, it ultimately means that potentially we're just burning trees, burning forests instead of coal. So is that a good idea?
No, absolutely not. But I come back to what I said earlier. The first step has to be using less energy, and that comes down in the home to proper insulation. When the Conservatives in 2012, Cameron and Osborne, cut the green crap, the amount of home insulation installations dropped by 90% within a year. You know, so that's where we need to start.
Well, you're right. And also, at that point, when the Conservatives took over the coalition government, we also saw all these solar farms popping up all over the place rather than on people's roofs. The solar generation was all going to private landowners. But look, what about Drax? Because as David said there, Drax is burning a tremendous amount of wood. And this doesn't really seem to me to be very green.
Absolutely. You know, Drax is burning clear-cut virgin forests from America. And the CO2 emissions, it just doesn't add up, as well as the obviously huge damage in clear-cutting these areas. And you know, we could quite easily, if we insulated the houses properly, close down Drax. You know, we could replace that with renewables, of the range of renewables we've talked about. But, you know, I completely agree with David and, you know, modern scientific thinking that Drax is a disaster burning clear-cut forests. And, you know, as mentioned, it still does emit CO2, and you can't really argue that it's sustainable because it takes 100 years to grow the tree that you've just burnt.
No. Anyway, if people are interested, Drax is open. They take you on tours around it, so you can watch all these trees going up in smoke if you want up there. Well, look, let's just move on to talk a bit about public transport, because we're seeing a lot of closing down. I mean, for example, here in Bristol, we've now got a clean air zone where you have to pay £10 or so every day to drive in and out. We've got the extension of the ultra low emission zone in London too, out to the M25 proposed, where actually what's going on in the background is a lot of communities are saying, for example, here in Bristol, we've got an area of a council estate now which has got no bus services left since the private company pulled the bus service backwards and forwards into Bristol. We'll start with you, David. What do you make of this policy? Because they're basically saying we're going to charge people more and more for using roads and using cars, and yet the alternatives don't really seem to be there.
Well, I think that what's being revealed, and that we've always suspected, is there's a creeping eco-dictatorship where a small body of people, unelected, unappointed, without any consent from the population, is slowly being pushed to give up our living standards and the standards of life. They want to take us. They want to stop us having cars. They want us to stop using cars. They want us to stop going on holidays. They want us to stop using planes. They want us to narrowly live within the 15-mile zone, where you don't come out of your shell or travel anywhere. There's a whole agenda being set behind the scenes here, which somebody, not us, have consented to. If you put the question of net zero and all of these restrictions to a referendum, I'll tell you now, we'd win 2-1. We would win to scrap the whole bloody thing.
Well, because isn't it the job of a responsible government to look after the environment? Anyway, how do you respond to that, Shane? Because there are a lot of people who believe that actually what's going on here is a driving down of living standards, particularly because, obviously we've become, over the last 40 or 50 years, people have become completely almost reliant on their cars. The old system of the big railway networks of the 1950s and 60s has gone. Since the public transport has been privatised, the price has gone up, and so the alternative to the car has sort of disappeared, hasn't it?
Look, I thought we were living under the most right-wing, extreme, near-on fascist conservative government we've ever had. And yet David talks about an eco-dictatorship. What are you on about? You know, the reason we want cars out of neighbourhoods is to improve air pollution, to allow kids to play in the streets, to allow birds back, not to be governed completely by the car.
But surely you can see that in order to get rid of the car, you've got to go back to a system of cheap, almost free public transport. I mean, public transport when I was growing up was very cheap, but it's not anymore. So there isn't any kind of alternative in place.
That's exactly what I was just about to say. You know, it has to be in tandem with vastly improved and nationalised public transport. At the moment, the bus companies are all privatised, and it's a
but it isn't. It isn't.
Sorry, what do you mean they're not privatised?
No,
I think what David's saying is there isn't a viable alternative. What do you think's the solution to this then? Because we seem to be bringing in these restrictions on using cars before the alternatives are there, Shane.
Yes, we need free, run by the state or the council, public transport, but we have to have less cars around. You know, air pollution in urban areas in London, kids' lungs are 11% smaller because of air pollution. No, we have to get back to local neighbourhoods where we have small shops nearby, public transport nearby. People don't have to get in the car and drive a few miles to the local supermarket and park there. You know, we want
whose plan is that?
Well, I'm trying to lay out a sort of green vision of a neighbourhood, a locality that is not based around the car, that is based around public transport, based around having shops and schools and everything nearby, so you can either walk or bicycle there. So we start to get the cars out of our neighbourhoods. Do you remember kids playing in the street, David? Do you remember bird songs in the street? That's what the 15-minute cities were about.
Of course I do. Of course I do. And I come from a community.
So that we're not dependent on the car.
I come from a community where that was the norm. You know, and I come from a childhood where that was the norm. But my issue with you is that you've drawn up a plan, and the more extreme versions of your politics in the form of a plan,
but you know, I'm
just Shane, just let him finish, please.
In the form of Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil, have decided on, you know, they've been visited by God. They've got this revelation that they're going to impose these restrictions upon us, whether we like it or not. That's what I object to. That's the dictatorship I'm talking about. And on a world scale, this whole eco panic is really designed to create international world government elected by nobody, accountable to nobody, with a whole set of rules that have been drawn up without our consent or consultation. That's what pains me about it.
Shane, I'll just let you answer that and then we'll get to the finish.
Yeah, that's a vast, vast misrepresentation of Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil. I mean, Just Stop Oil are calling for no new oil or gas in the North
Which
Sea.
Which grinds everywhere to a standstill.
Hang on, David, just let him finish.
And what Extinction Rebellion have done in 3 or 4 years is that they have widened the conversation to allow us to talk about the possibilities of extinction if we carry on as business as usual.
Absolutely, utter rubbish.
Fine, but let him finish what he's saying, please, David.
Okay.
Extinction Rebellion are not about pushing solutions. You know, Extinction Rebellion don't have a manifesto that says you must do this, you must do that. What Extinction Rebellion is saying, tell the truth, the government and the media should tell the truth. We should have citizens' assemblies to decide upon the way forward. And we've got to get to net zero by 2025 to have any chance of keeping below 1.5-2 degrees. All right, Extinction Rebellion,
right.
David. Really, I know the people involved very well. They are not about, we don't have a manifesto. We're not saying you must do this. We're saying tell the truth. Citizens' assemblies, and let's get to net zero.
Okay, well, look, can I just ask you both to sum up?
Wait a minute. If you're going to sit in the road blocking people going to an airport on the holidays, then you don't need a bloody manifesto. You're imposing your view on us. If you're going to say no oil, it means we can't do anything with the oil. And incidentally,
Shane has pretty well explained that he thinks that these citizens' assemblies will come up with a solution. But I'd like you, first of all, David, to give us your vision of a future. I'm thinking particularly about our transport needs and our energy needs.
Right. Well, there's a lot more to be said about that. Like, you can't run a wind turbine without oil, for example. You use 700 litres a year for an average size.
Yeah, but what can
my
you
vision,
do? What can we
be,
do and what should
first
we
of all,
do?
First of all, I would scrap net zero. That has nobody's consent, nobody's agreement. We should stop all gas-powered generation and build a whole new fleet of clean coal power stations, which don't emit CO2. We obviously need to open the coke and coal mine in order to make steel, in order to make wind turbines or anything else made of steel, because you can't make steel, new steel, without coal. We are to open another 30 new coal mines in order to produce the coal for a clean coal power station. I would cancel all nuclear programs. Obviously, the electrification of the railway, as long as the grid is supplied by clean coal and clean fossil fuel. I would develop shale gas in areas of low population. that and transport really should be free.
Well, that's so a good point. I mean, you've just made an absolutely brilliant point there, because I remember in London in the 1980s, you probably do as well, Shane, when Ken Livingstone introduced his fare policy, the actual use of cars started to plummet and people started using much more public transport. That is to say, the tubes, the trains, the buses were full of people. And in Londoners started thinking, well, actually, we don't need a car anymore. And of course, Bromley Council, the Tory council, put an end to that and actually overturned what had been Ken Livingstone's big manifesto pledge. So that was one way of getting rid of cars. But anyway, what's your vision for the future of energy and particularly of our ability to get around, Shane?
I just wanted to ask David, you know, you gave a long list of things. Do you see any role for renewables, David?
I've got no objection to them other than they're ugly, they're unsightly. They spoil our natural places of natural beauty, landscapes, seascapes. They kill thousands of birds all the time. But other than that, if you're obsessed by them, as long as you realise you need coal to make them.
But well, I think it's also worth saying that oil spillages also kill quite a lot of birds. Can I just ask you, Shane, just to sum up, what is your vision? We're talking about maybe even 20, 30, 40 years in the future. What is our energy use going to look like and our ability to get around? I mean, one of the big changes we've seen in my lifetime is the pretty much ending of the reliance on the trains, because it's cheaper to get around by car. That's obviously got to end. But I mean, what about our ability to get around and our energy use? Where would you like to see it going?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm in the Green Party. We want to renationalise the railways, absolutely. Renationalise energy companies. But I think if we're looking 20, 30 years ahead, and we have business as usual in the meantime, you know, we are going to be looking at a vast shortage of food around the world. We're going to be looking at a fairly hellish future, and that's why young people are terrified, and so am I, and that's why, you know, young people are getting involved in Just Stop Oil, because we don't want to see new oil, and we're bloody terrified about the future. You know, it is horrendous, and I know, David, you don't seem to recognize this, but there is a lot of young people who are genuinely scared.
I don't.
About what's coming down the road, and that's
why I recognise that.
But what sort of pattern of energy use do you see in the future? What would you like to see, Shane?
Well, I would like to see demand cut through proper home insulation, and I would like to see bicycle lanes wherever there are roads, electric bicycles being used far more because they are a new mode of transport. Electric cars, although we obviously can't replace 40 million cars with electric cars, but there can be some, a publicly run transport system, and flying very, very, I mean, ideally, I'd like to see we get a carbon ration. And if green people, poor people don't use their ration, they can sell it to people who want to go and see their parents in New Zealand or whatever.
Along with the kidneys.
That will redistribute wealth, David, you'd be interested in. That will redistribute wealth.
Right, back to the rich.
And from the rich to the poor, because the poor and the greens will be selling the bit of their quota they don't use to wealthy people.
What David's hinting at there, that there is, Shane, quite a lot of criticism of this idea of marketizing carbon, you know, turning it into carbon credits and buying and selling it around the world.
Well, if it's done as a quota, it's a very different thing, because by right of being in this country, you get free a quota.
Yeah.
Okay. And each year that quota decreases by 9%, so that by 10 years' time, we're getting down to zero emissions. But in the meantime, there will be a huge redistribution of wealth, because wealthy people will want to buy the quota off people who live a greener lifestyle.
So that's
Yeah, the full version of that debate, which is over an hour, will be on our show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Shane Collins from the Green Party and Extinction Rebellion versus David Douglas from the National Union of Mine Workers, and he's author of Climate Change and the Total Destruction of the British Coal Industry. And I'll put a link up. You can actually buy that from AK Press. I didn't realise that when I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, from online. I think it's priced £15, his book. I still haven't seen a copy of it. He sent me something in the post, I think it was a couple of weeks ago. Still haven't got that. Or maybe a week ago. We'll see. So anyway, Martin, what did you make of the discussion? I think it's pretty high level there. The main thing seems to be that the Extinction Rebellion are very clear about what they don't want to see, but they're not very clear about how to sort it out. They've decided to sort of outsource the solutions to these people's assemblies.
Yeah, I think what was also interesting is what common ground there was. I mean, it's a no-brainer that we ought to have publicly owned public transport, which people can use for free. I mean, why aren't we doing it?
Well, isn't it finance capitalism that's at the root of the
exactly.
Problem?
So the real problem is that nothing is really going to be done about any of the real problems we face, because the capitalist system itself is in a terminal crisis. And there's quite a distinct possibility. I mean, young people today are worried about climate change. We used to worry about nuclear war. They should worry more about nuclear war. And if you're going to worry about nuclear war, you then get involved in what you might call hardcore politics, not just gesture politics, like recycling.
Well, yeah, but you're suggesting that all these young people in London at the moment who are the big one part of that protest, Shane is saying that they're very concerned about the environment in the future. And you say that they've been conned?
I think that I had some training in project management, Tony. And what you have to do is you have to decide what your priorities actually are if you're going to do anything. Now, I think the priorities facing the world at the moment are A, nuclear war, B, financial collapse, C, civil wars on the back of that. If people are shooting at you, it's quite difficult to sit in the road. And of course, the environment in general is a major issue, and that isn't just climate change. So what's actually happened is what began as a green, decentralized movement is being instrumentalized by major capitalist forces who need a new legitimation after the collapse of the banks in 2008. And so the major legitimation of the Davos World Economic Forum people is we look like finance capitalists who are just ripping everybody off, being bailed out by the taxpayer. But in actual fact, we want to save the world. And that's why you should support what we're trying to do. I think there is an awful lot of common ground in terms of changing the society in the right direction. You heard there the Extinction Rebellion person doesn't agree with burning trees in power stations. I would argue that we need a diversified energy infrastructure, and that it probably implies a bit of everything, not necessarily nuclear, because it's just not economic. Although once you've got a nuclear power station, you might as well run it to the end of its natural life, because the waste, which is the real problem, ain't going anywhere. You're stuck with that, whatever you do. There are no absolute solutions. I think net zero as a slogan leads to a situation where people, you know, they're paying for the moon there. We can reduce the amount of energy we use, and we can reduce the more destructive aspects of that energy, whether it's oil spills or open cast coal mines in indigenous communities in the developing world. But we're never going to have a perfect solution to work for it all. And it's necessarily going to be long drawn out and quite.
In the meantime, the Chinese are laughing up their sleeve at us, aren't they?
They're not laughing. They're just trying to give the people of their country the same kind of privileges we have.
And funnily enough, I mean, there isn't a gigantic
revolution where they fought the Japanese and they threw the Japanese out, just as we threw the Germans out.
Yeah, well, they want to benefit from that. The Chinese must realise that there is no gigantic, great big see-through plastic wall in the sky that separates the climate over China to the climate over here.
Well, but Martin, Chinese, I think the Chinese have agreed to negotiate that both China and Russia.
Yeah, but they're still building coal-fired power stations. They're still building coal-fired power stations, and also they do see.
We're allowed to build coal-fired power stations, Tony. Just because they're building coal-fired power stations doesn't mean that they're not serious about climate change. Developing countries in Africa, we're probably going to have loads of coal-fired power stations, but that means that the wealthy part of the world, the golden billion, as Lavrov calls them, will have to make the sacrifice.
Isn't it funny?
Not just the poor. The poor in the wealthy countries shouldn't have to make sacrifices.
Isn't it funny that when it comes to
instead of having redistribution,
Martin,
we may just have to take the money off them. Just take it off them. Not
isn't it funny how back in the days of nuclear disarmament, the idea of us just doing it, what was it, unilateral nuclear disarmament was seen to be utterly terrible and stupid, whereas it comes to unilateral decarbonisation is fine.
Well, it's not unilateral because most of these things have been agreed at these
Brits are doing a faster rate than almost any other country on earth, getting rid of their coal-fired power stations, going over to windmills.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in actual fact, as I just said, the idea is that certain countries are going to be allowed to increase their carbon emissions as they industrialise. And if we're going to make allowance for that, that means that the countries that are already industrialised have to make the sacrifices. It shouldn't be the poor people in those countries. It should be the rich people in those countries.
Well, okay,
but in any case, none of this is going to happen because there is no agreement. We're going to World War III now. There will be no agreements about climate change till that's over. And, of course, that could end in a nuclear war, and that will cause climate change. CND's demand on Britain to get rid of its nuclear weapons is a perfectly logical demand.
It won't be a change of one degree.
Probably do.
It won't be a change of 1 degree. It will be a change of 30 or 40 degrees down, and there'll be a nuclear winter. Now, we've got just looking at developments around the world, we must start on Sudan because we neglected to talk about it last week, which was rather remiss. But this week, there's been a ceasefire, which has been extended, but the fighting apparently is still going on over there. We're going to hear now from Bristol councillor Mohamed Makawi. He's a Green councillor. And here what he's explaining is that the Russians and the Chinese have been over in Sudan. They've been doing deals with the government, and actually the militia, which used to be called the Ganjaweed militia, and that of course is a code for the US deep state, the CIA and MI6, using a private army over there to trade drugs. Now, apparently, they're being funded largely by the United Arab Emirates. And what happens is, as soon as a government starts to go off message, and the AFRICOM in Stuttgart will have a good old look at them and say, well, okay, let's fire up our militias to cause chaos in the country, because we're sending a message to the government that they're not going to be dealing with the Chinese and the Russians. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to Mohamed Makawi. The two main protagonists there are the Sudanese army and something called the RSF, the Rapid Speedy Force, but actually the S, I think, stands for something else. So he's got a very good, he's born in Sudan, and he keeps a very close eye. He did the Sudanese show, which came just after us on BCFM all those years ago, before we were booted out by the mafia there. So let's see what Mohamed Makawi's got to say about these manoeuvrings, and who's really in charge.
The Russians, they're trying, the Chinese, they're trying, even the United States, they never came and they asked for like a base, naval or even an air base. But they will not like it, and even the Israelis, they will not like it. And they ask. They not, because we got a transition government. There is no such a government. It's not even military government or even democratic government coming yet. So the deal, it is between the fraction which is fighting now, the Mohammed Hamdan Hemeti, aka Mohammed Hamdan, his aka name is Hemeti, the rabbit Speedy Force leader, he went and done that deal with the Russian because he got interested with them in discovering the gold from Sudan, because they got a deal with the government before him and even this government to take the gold from Sudan to United Arab Emirates from there to Russia. So there is interest between all of them. So he said, okay, I'm going to give you this Navy base, but I don't think it's going to happen soon. I don't know if it's going to happen at all. And we don't actually, as a Sudanese, I don't like to have any base, a naval or air base from any of the superpower or any of the power.
That's a bit of a pipe dream nowadays, because it's very difficult for countries like Sudan, if not impossible, to function and still be independent. In the Rapid Support Forces, this is the anti-government faction that's suddenly become very, very militant. I mean, they must be getting their resources from somewhere. I mean, initially, it was, I think, part of the government of Sudan's forces, and grew out of something called the Janjaweed Militia.
Yeah, right.
Who is supporting it? Who is paying for this? Because you can't run an army like that on thin air.
Yeah, actually, it's been created by the ousted President Omar al-Bashir since 2013 with different names, 2003 with different names. Until 2007, they changed their name to the Border Security Guard. And after that, they called them, 2013, they got this name, the Rabbit Speed Force. And they used to do the dirty work for Omar al-Bashir in Darfur. So they commit the genocide in Darfur, and so he used to pay them a lot of money, even neglecting the Sudanese army. And because he's afraid of the Sudanese army, so he don't want them to have any power to trouble him, so to have a coup against him.
So how do the Rapid Support Forces actually fund themselves, or is it just simply the hand? I mean, you do wonder, don't you, as the Americans are watching and seeing the Russians negotiate for a naval base in Port Sudan, that perhaps the Americans have just said, right, here's lots of money, here's some new weapons, make trouble for the government so they don't allow this base.
You know what? The Europeans, they are involved, the Russians are involved, the United Arab and Saudi are involved of funding them, because the Saudi and United Arab Emirates, since 2015, they fund them because of they send them soldiers to defend them in Yemen and fight in behalf of them. So that's a lot of money coming from there.
This is clever, isn't it? Because the money is not coming from, say, United States or NATO or whatever. It's coming through their kind of proxy forces in the Middle East.
Yes. And Omar al-Bashir, he gave them a gold mountain, actually. They called it Jebel Amir in west of Sudan. So that's another source of income to them. That's what makes the relationship between them and Russia, because they have a tie of digging gold. The European Union use the Rapid Force and pay them to stop the illegal immigrant from Sudan, to Libya and from there to Europe. So they used to pay them a lot of money as well. So, yeah.
So could you see any way to peace and an independent government in Sudan after all these years now, several years of trouble?
Without this militia, we can, because this militia, it was troubled from day one, I mean, since the revolution started, and we knew, because this the old regime coming and want to take a piece of the cake. And he, I mean, the rebel force leader, he's dreaming to be the leader of Sudan, to be the president of Sudan. So he can do anything to get there. And so the fighting over in Sudan, because his militia is not an it's not an army, it's a militia. Okay? So he wants to rule with them. So unless he out of the equation, I don't think we're gonna have any peace. So, and I don't I see the international community taking him as part of the solution, but he's a part of the problem. So I think that to recognize him, and now especially he is starting this fight, and he's a rebel now. I mean, as the army said. So I don't know why they're dealing with him, why they're giving him a time of the day to be part of anything after what he's committing. And there is, I mean, what's going on in Khartoum is unimaginable. And not only in Khartoum, in different cities in Sudan, people that are fleeing. We never had something like this in Sudan, in the cities. Neither, I mean, even in Darfur, it wasn't in the cities. What's happened? It's not, war is bad anywhere, but to have, I mean, a war in the capital, which is, there's 10 million inhabitants in that city. And now these people, they are in siege. Like people, my family over there, I'm worried, sick, you know, for them. And I don't know what's going to happen, because the fight in from street to street.
So that's Councillor Mohamed Bakawi from Bristol, the authentic voice from Sudan. Martin, it's quite obvious what's going on, really, is the West is funding a bunch of maniacs which were initially set up as supposedly there to try and stop the mass migration around Africa and the, you know, porous borders. But actually now they're being used and funded by United Arab Emirates and the Israelis, who of course are, you know, really working for the United States as a proxy, just to kill people and cause trouble in Sudan, because the Americans are worried about China and Russia getting some sort of foothold there.
Well, I think that's one interpretation of events. I wouldn't be that certain that I know more than Mohammed knows, for example, about the history of it all. Sudan has had a very sad recent history, and of course it was part of the British Empire, remember? We conquered it, the Mad Mahdi and all the rest of it, General Kitchener, and therefore, of course, just like the Hong Kong Chinese or the Ukrainians, they may end up in our country because, yeah, they were part of the British Empire, they really were. And of course, Britain left Sudan in a fairly bad state at the end of when we withdrew in the 1950s, and so on. And people forget all about this.
I mean, this is all deliberate. Exactly. Now, I don't think people are forgetting about it. I just think it's deliberate. These countries are turned into basket cases deliberately. Then the international traffickers start to say, well, all these people living in these countries where it's an absolute nightmare, let's traffic them over to countries which are relatively civilized and stable to undermine the trade union movements and to cause trouble for organized labor, particularly in Europe, in all countries, in all developed parts of the developed world.
Yeah, but it's not just that. I mean, Sudan is an indebted developing country. So money leaves Sudan every day and arrives in the City of London and is paid out to people in the City of London, who then spend it on housing and property in the City of London, which drives up the prices, which means that people...
But what about the geopolitics in the Red Sea? Because this is a very important part of the world.
The geopolitics in the Red Sea are very sharp, very sharp. You've got the war in Yemen, which is really about Saudi Arabia and the West trying to control it.
As Mohammed says there, I mean, it looks like things are winding down in Yemen just as they're ramping up in Sudan.
Well, I wouldn't count too many chickens about Yemen.
If the Saudis and the Iranians are starting to come to peace agreements, then, you know, surely Yemen is going to, you know, I think there's already been some.
There's a possibility of it being resolved, and it's good news that the Chinese have managed to knock heads together there. But the devastation in Yemen has been incredible, far worse than in Ukraine, for example, which everybody gets fussed about. And what may well happen, I fear, in Yemen is that Nasrullah will be sidelined by the Saudis by doing deals with the Iranians. Well, the Nasrullah and what their demands are may be sidelined. In Sudan itself, there was a movement towards democracy and to get rid of military rule there. And the military government, in theory, is a transitional government for preparing for a transition to democracy. But that's all stalled now. I'm quite sure that the whole of Africa has always been a battleground for outside powers. Sudan, definitely part of that.
So, what do you make of the global military spending increasing? I mean, I did an interview with a press TV this week, and I was asking the question, are they planning a war? Are they planning a third world war? And I was also wondering who elected anybody to ramp up military spending. I haven't seen anybody in Europe being elected on that platform at all.
Well, you'll find that like the Labour Party is, for example, in this country, is committed to spending 2% of GDP on military spending. So if they get elected, that will be in their manifesto. And that is true. You know, you can say that it's not elected. The political system is rigged. It's rigged by the military industrial complex, and they want money spent on wars. And the war in the Ukraine has led to a situation where the military industrial complex is making loads of money.
The Israelis are moaning
because it's national.
Martin, the Israelis are moaning because the US is depleting its stockpiles of ammunition. The Israelis are saying you shouldn't be doing that.
Well, what's happened in the Ukraine is they thought the Russian economy would collapse and they'd be walking in there. In actual fact, the Russian economy isn't collapsing. It's consolidating. It's the Western European economies, including Eastern Europe. I mean, the Poles are pushing, they're cheering along the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. You feel like saying, what do you think is going to happen to the Polish economy? And I used to live in Poland. What do you think is going to happen to the Polish economy when the German economy collapses and you're not trading with the Russians? Do you think you think Uncle Sam's going to turn up?
Another major story this week relates to China. The House Committee in the United States is preparing proposals to arm Taiwan. So this is any of the weapons that are not going to go to Ukraine are going to go to Taiwan. And the Chinese have denounced the U.S. plans to dock nuclear-armed subs in South Korea. So the Americans do really seem to be, well, not poking the bear, but poking the tiger this time.
Or the dragon, as it may be.
Oh, the dragon. Okay.
I mean, it was pretty clear. I'll try and be brief and to the point. The plandemic was an attempt to knock down the Chinese economy before it got too big for the Americans to handle.
But it was an international attack. It wasn't China, Martin.
No, it's an international attack. But the idea was to give China the kick in the testicles, and then it would flow back over everybody else, and they could bring in vaccine mandates, digital currency, all the things that people are concerned about. But the initial attack and the purpose of the attack is to destroy the Chinese economy. It didn't, because they adopted
They're trying to destroy the Russian economy too. That's failing as well. These tacticians in NATO and the United States and Europe are hopeless.
Well, that's right. That's the good news. Because in actual fact, if they succeeded, that would have been terrible. But they haven't succeeded. The Russian economy hasn't collapsed. The Chinese economy is growing at 6% this year. The British economy is growing at 0%. And over time, that's going to lead to a situation where the Chinese, as long as they keep their nerve and don't make any mistakes, are going to win World War III.
Well, that's not going to be easy. But look, I mean, the big solution to all of this is if we get a decent US president, and Robert F. Kennedy's announced last weekend he's standing to be that president. He must be sort of maybe wearing his arm-plated shirts as well, because quite obviously his father and his uncle were assassinated because of their attempts to get the US presidency. So he's obviously thinking similar thoughts. But I thought we'd have a listen to his very long speech he did at a stadium in the US last weekend. And so I think it was about 2 hours long, but it's a pretty incredible speech if you compare it to the sorts of things that we haven't heard anything really of this on the mainstream press here. And you'll probably hear why when you hear now from Robert F. Kennedy in his announcement that he'd be standing to be US president for the Democrat nomination.
One of the enclaves of the commercial fishery on the Hudson is a little village called Crotonville, New York. It's 30 miles north of New York City on the east bank of the river. And the people who lived there in 1966 were not your prototypical, you know, mainstream environmentalists. They were affluent. They were not affluent. They were the opposite of that. They were carpenters, lathers, factory workers, electricians. Half the people in Crotonville made their living, or at least some part of it, fishing or grabbing the Hudson. These were people who had little expectation that they'd ever see Yellowstone or Yosemite or the national parks. They didn't have the money to take their families on those kind of vacations. For them, the environment was the backyard. It was the bathing beaches, the swimming holes, the fishing holes of the Hudson. That was their livelihood. It was their recreation. It was their food. And Richie Garrett, who was the first president of the Riverkeeper User of the Fishermen's Association, used to say about the Hudson, it's our Riviera, it's our Monte Carlo. Richie Garrett was a gravedigger from Wassaming, New York. He used to tell his new followers, I'll be the last to let you down. And in 1966, Penn Central Railroad began vomiting oil from a 4.5-foot pipe in the Croton Harmon rail yard. And the oil went up the river on the tides, and it blackened the beaches, and it made the shad taste of diesel. So they couldn't be sold in the Fulton Fish Market in New York City. And all the people in Crotonville came together in the only public building in the town, which was the American Legion Hall. This is a very patriotic community. Crotonville and the neighboring village of Wassaming had one of the highest enlistment and mortality rates during World War II, and almost all of the original Riverkeeper board and officers and members were former Marines. They were combat veterans from World War II in Korea. Richie Garrett was a former Marine. These weren't radicals. They weren't militants. They were people whose patriotism was rooted in the bedrock of our country. But that night, they started talking about violence because they saw something that they thought they owned, which was the abundance of these fisheries and the purity and richness of the Hudson River's waters. And it was being robbed from them by large corporate entities over whom they had no control. And they'd been to the government agencies that are supposed to protect Americans from pollution, the Corps of Engineers, the Conservation Department, the Coast Guard, and they were given the bum's rush. Richie Garrett made more than a dozen separate visits to the Corps of Engineers office in Manhattan, begging the Corps colonel to do his job and shut down the Penn Central pipe. And the colonel finally told them in exasperation, these are important people. Speaking of the Penn Central Board of Directors, we can't treat them that way. In other words, we can't force them to comply with the law. So this was classic agency capture. These agencies, these regulatory agencies, had become the sock puppets for the industry they were supposed to be regulating. And by this evening in March of 1966, 300 men and women came together in that American Legion Hall in Crotonville, and all of them had come to the conclusion that government was in cahoots with the polluters. And the only way they were going to reclaim the river for themselves is if they confronted the polluters directly. And somebody suggested they put a match to the oil slick coming out of the Penn Central pipe and burn it up. Somebody else said they should roll a mattress up and jam it up the pipe and flood the rail yard with its own waste. Somebody else said they should float a raft of dynamite into the intake of the Indian Point power plant, which at that time was killing 1 million fish a day on its intake screens and taking food off their family tables. And then a guy stood up named Bob Boyle. He was a first lieutenant, combat vet from Korea. He was also by then a world-famous fly fisherman and spin fisherman. He was the outdoor editor of Sports Illustrated for 70 years. 2 years earlier, he'd written an article about angling in the Hudson for Sports Illustrated. And in researching it, he had come across an ancient navigational statute called the 1888 Rivers and Harbors Act. And that statute said it was illegal to pollute any waterway in the United States. You had to pay a big penalty if you got caught. But also there was a bounty provision that said anybody who turned in the polluter got to keep half the fine. And he had checked it out with lawyers. The law had never been enforced in 80 years, but it was still on the books. And that evening, he stood in front of this group, and he said, we shouldn't be talking about breaking the law. We should be talking about enforcing it. And they resolved that evening that they were going to... go out and track down and prosecute every polluter in the Hudson. 18 months later, they shut down the Penn Central pipe. He got to keep $2,000. There was 2 weeks of wild celebration in the town. They used the money that was left over to go after Siva Geigy, Tuck Tape, Standard Brand, American Cyanamid, the biggest corporation in America, and winning. In 1973, they collected the highest penalty in the United States history against a corporate polluter. They got $200,000 from Anaconda Wire and Cable for dumping toxins at Hastings in New York. They used that money to build a boat. They hired a full-time riverkeeper, a former commercial fisherman, John Cronin. They hired me using bounty money as their attorney. And over the next couple of decades, we bought over 500 successful legal actions against Hudson River polluters. And today, the Hudson River is an international model for ecosystem protection. This is a river that caught fire. It was dead for 20-mile stretches north of New York City, south of Albany. It turned colors depending on what color they were painting the GM trucks at Tarrytown, the Tarrytown GM plant. Today, it's the richest waterway in the North Atlantic. It produces more pounds of fish per acre. And more biomass per gallon than any other waterway in the Atlantic Ocean north of the equator. And the miraculous resurrection of the Hudson has inspired the creation of river keepers, water keepers, now 350 of them in 46 countries. We're now the biggest water protection group in the world. The story of the Hudson also has a sad ending because General Electric Company dumped its PCBs into the Hudson to save money at its capacitator plant. And the PCBs, although they've spent $1 billion trying to get them out, there's another $3.5 billion that nobody's ever going to pay. The commercial fish are, many of the species are too toxic to eat, and it's the commercial fishery has been almost altogether closed. 2,000 families that I represented, now there's probably two left. And those are families that enrich the history, the culture, the palate of New York for 3.5 centuries. And they're gone not because their business plan didn't work, because it did work for 3.5 centuries. The thing that didn't work, free market capitalism worked perfectly for them. What didn't work was corporate crony capitalism, was the General Electric Company had better lobbyists. If General Electric did not have a better business plan, it just had better lobbyists, so it was able to escape the discipline of the free market, corrupt public officials, dump its PCBs in the river, put, you know, my fishermen out of work, and everybody in the Hudson Valley now has General Electric's PCBs in their flesh and organs. And that's what corporate crony capitalism does. One of the things that I learned from the fishermen is that there's no daylight between good environmental policy and good economic policy. And you'll hear this mantra, this trope from the big polluters and their indentured servants on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, that we have to choose between economic prosperity and environmental protection. And that's a false choice. In 100% of the situation, good environmental policy is identical to good economic policy. if we want to measure our economy, this is how we ought to be measuring it, based upon how it produces jobs and the dignity of jobs over the generations, and how it preserves the value of the assets of our community. If, on the other hand, we want to do what the big polluters are urging us to do, which is to treat the planet as if it were business in liquidation, convert our natural resources to cash as quickly as possible, have a few years of pollution-based prosperity, we can generate an instantaneous cash flow and the illusion of a prosperous economy, and we can make a few people billionaires by impoverishing the rest of us. But our children are going to pay for our joyride, and they're going to pay for it with denuded landscapes, poor health, huge cleanup costs that aren't going to amplify over time and that they'll never be able to pay. Environmental injury is deficit spending. It's a way of loading the cost of our generation's prosperity onto the backs of our children. And one of the things that I've done over the past 30 years as an environmental advocate is to constantly go around and confront this argument that an investment in our environment is a diminishment of our nation's wealth. It doesn't diminish our wealth. It's an investment in infrastructure, the same as investing in telecommunications or road construction. It's an investment we have to make if we're going to ensure the economic vitality of our generation and future generations. And by the way, you know, we're not protecting the environment just for the sake of the fish and the birds. We're protecting it for our own sake, because those things enrich us. They enrich us economically, spiritually, culturally, and all these other ways. If we want to meet our obligation as a generation, as a civilization, as a nation, which is to create communities for our children that provide them with the same opportunities for dignity and enrichment and prosperity and good health as the communities that our parents gave us, we've got to start by protecting our environmental infrastructure, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the wildlife, the fisheries, the public lands, those things that are not reducible to private property, but by their nature are the property of all of us, the commons, the commonwealth, the public trust assets, the landscapes, the waterways that connect us to the 10,000 generations of human beings that lived before there were laptops, and that ultimately connect us to God. And God talks to human beings through many vectors, through each other, through organized religion, through the great books of those religions, through wise people, through art and music and literature and poetry, but nowhere with such detail and grace and color and joy as through creation. And when we... When we destroy a species, when we destroy a special place, we're diminishing our capacity to sense the divine, understand who God is, and what our own potential is as human beings. And Father Martin once told me that the definition of sin is an injury to another human being or to God, to our relationship with God. And when we... You know, when we eliminate, my children are going to grow up in a world where they will never see the kind of explosions of color from butterflies that I saw every time I walked into my garden. Because 80 or 90% of the butterflies are gone, the flying insects. They'll never hear the songbirds that I heard, because 80% of them are gone. They'll never see the amphibians, the puddles that I saw as a boy, bubbling like cauldrons with tadpoles from salamanders and frogs. They're not going to see that in their lifetime. They're unaware of it. And it's like God is a tapestry, and he's talking to us from all of these different vectors. And we're pulling threads out of that capacity. And it is such a crime against our children. And I think... I think we deserve a president in this country who cares about these things and who talks about these things to the American people. I want to say one other thing. Nature is a social safety net. When we had the Great Depression, 10,000 men who lost their jobs went down to the Hudson River to find oysters and blue crabs and sturgeon and shad and herring and alewives, and they fed themselves, their family, and some made money. And that was all. Nature is our social safety net. It's infrastructure. They can't do that if there's another depression. You know, we're relying on the government to give us money, but that's not reliable. Nature was always reliable.
So that's Robert Kennedy there, quite an amazing speech by a bit of a breath of fresh air. I guess he's a bit of a threat to the establishment. I mean, the sort of speeches that have been coming out of Joe Biden, I think he's going to win hands down.
Well, I understand that Biden has said that there are going to be no debates in the democratic
nomination
process.
Wonder why. Oh, but what a breath of fresh air, though, Martin, to hear him talking
about
this.
Well, yes, and I wish him well, but obviously he's got an uphill struggle because the system's rigged. And even if you finally get there, you've got to deal with the bullet in the back. And that's America today, isn't it?
Yeah, so that was a speech in Boston. He's called anti-vaccine conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but of course he's not just that. He's someone who's been a stalwart of the one of the leading Democrat families for many decades.
Well, he has, and of course that was quite a detailed story of his own work as a lawyer working for environmental causes. And you can see that, you know, he's got an enthusiastic audience there in Boston. That is his hometown, obviously. And he's going to try and do what Bernie Sanders did in the attempt to try and steal the nomination from Hillary Clinton. But Biden is the sitting president, and he's not going to, you know, he's going to play that to the hilt and say, I'm not going to prepare to talk with
Biden
and Kennedy because I don't have to. I'm already the president. But it may well be that Biden, I think the Democrat managers have got a real problem because Biden's just too old. You know, he's just too old. And Kamala Harris is not necessarily able to take over from him because she hasn't got the necessary support.
Well, I wonder which of those two candidates
didn't get any support. How can they find anybody else?
I wonder which of those two candidates the satanic banksters will be betting on. Of course, this is the deep state. We shall see. Anyway, you know, it's very, very brave of him and brilliant. I thought it was an absolutely superb speech to do with, the regulatory capture. I mean, he's saying basically exactly what we say week after week after week. You've got to have a non-fascist country. And that's what's happened in the United States and Britain, is that these big corporations have now taken over much of the regulation. Look at June Rain and the MHRA, the Medical Regulation Group. And she's completely useless. She's not working for the public. She's working for Big Pharma. Another one, we were talking earlier on about Andrew Bridgen and Diane Abbott being cancelled, but what about Tucker Carlson? Let's have a listen here to his actual speech. This was, he did a sort of rather puny little chit-chat because obviously there's been a non-disclosure agreement, an out-of-court settlement, as we were talking about last week. But I didn't realise Tucker Carlson was going to get the sack too. For Fox News with this dispute with the Dominion Voting Company. But we'll talk about that after we've heard a speech from Tucker Carlson, which was his last address before leaving Fox News, talking about how the debate has changed in his lifetime.
I don't think we're watching a debate over how to get to the best outcome. I think that's completely wrong. And I've come to this conclusion, and I should say at the outset, I'm an Episcopalian, so don't take any theological advice from me, because I don't have any. I grew up in the shallowest faith tradition that's ever been invented. It's not even a Christian religion at this point. I say with shame. But I'm just saying this as an observer of what's going on. There is no way to assess, say, the transgenderist movement with that mindset. Policy papers don't account for it at all. If you have people who are saying, I have an idea, let's castrate the next generation. Let's sexually mutilate children. I'm sorry, that's not a political debate. What? It has nothing to do with politics. What's the outcome we're desiring here? An androgynous population? Is that really what are we arguing for that? I don't think anyone could defend that as a positive outcome. But the weight of the government and a lot of corporate interests are behind that. Well, what is that? Well, it's irrational. If you say, I think abortion is always bad. Well, I think sometimes it's necessary. That's a debate I'm familiar with. But if you're telling me that abortion is a positive good, what are you saying? Well, you're arguing for child sacrifice, obviously. It's not about a teen girl gets pregnant and what do we do about that? And victims of rape. I get it. Of course, I understand that. And I have compassion for everyone involved. But when the Treasury Secretary stands up and says, you know what you can do to help the economy? Get an abortion. Well, that's like an Aztec principle, actually. There's not a society in history that didn't practice human sacrifice. Not one. I checked. Even the Scandinavians, I'm ashamed to say. It wasn't just the Mesoamericans, it was everybody. So, that's what that is. Well, what's the point of child sacrifice? Well, there's no policy goal entwined with that. No, that's a theological phenomenon. And that's kind of the point I'm making. None of this makes sense in conventional political terms. When people or crowds of people or the largest crowd of people at all, which is the federal government, the largest human organization in human history, decide that the goal is to destroy things, destruction for its own sake. Hey, let's tear it down. What you're watching is not a political movement. It's evil. So if you want to assess, non-specific theological terms, and just say, if you want to know what's evil and what's good, what are the characteristics of those? And by the way, I think the Athenians would have agreed with this. This is not necessarily just a Christian notion. This is kind of widely agreed upon understanding of good and evil. What are its products? What do these two conditions produce? Well, good is characterized by order, calmness, tranquility, peace, whatever you want to call it, lack of conflict, cleanliness. Cleanliness is next to godliness. It's true. It is. And evil is characterized by their opposites. Violence, hate, disorder, division, disorganization, and filth. So if you are all in on the things that produce the latter basket of outcomes, what you're really advocating for is evil. That's just true. I'm not calling for a religious war. Far from it. I'm merely calling for an acknowledgement of what we're watching, which is not what, and I'm not certainly not backing the Republican Party. I'm not making a partisan point at all. I'm just noting what's super obvious. Those of us who are in our mid-50s are caught in the past in the way that we think about this. One side's like, no, I've got this idea, and we've got this idea, and let's have a debate about our ideas. They don't want a debate. Those ideas won't produce outcomes that any rational person would want under any circumstances. Those are manifestations of some larger force acting upon us. It's just so obvious. It's completely obvious. And I think two things. One, we should say that and stop engaging in these totally fraudulent debates where we are using the terms that we used in 1991 when I started at Heritage as if maybe, I could just win the debate if I marshaled more facts. I've tried that, doesn't work. And two, maybe we should all take just 10 minutes a day to say a prayer about it. I'm serious. Why not? And I'm saying that to you, not as some kind of evangelist. I'm literally saying that to you as an Episcopalian, the Samaritans of our time.
I'm coming to you from the most humble and lowly theological position you can. I'm literally an Episcopalian, okay? And even I have concluded it might be worth taking just 10 minutes out of your busy schedule to say a prayer for the future, and I hope you will.
Well, another kind of evangelical speech there, but that's Tucker Carlson just before he got the sack, Martin. He's firing reveals, says Jonathan Cook, Bristol-based journalist, ex-Guardian, how afraid the media is of independent journalists. The TV host has paid the price because he tried the impossible, straddling the divide between corporate media and critical journalism. While the left, says Jonathan, is busy hating on Tucker Carlson, and not without reason, it's missing the bigger picture. He was a genuine aberration in US corporate media, which is why he's gone, sacked by media titan Rupert Murdoch. Well, the actual nuts and bolts of why he was sacked seems obvious to me, pretty obvious. I mean, you've got to do a bit of educated guesswork, because last week we had the Dominion's voting story, which Tucker Carlson ran. And it seems obvious to me that Dominion, as part of their out-of-court settlement, demanded his head. So that's something that Rupert Murdoch would have been – he would have been faced with that, but possibly losing his media empire if they went to court, or else settling out of court and sacking Tucker Carlson. The other interesting thing about Carlson is, despite his absolutely amazing ratings, the advertising revenue for him apparently was quite small, because the advertisers had already started pulling ads because politically the big corporations didn't like what he was doing. So anyway, what do you make of – I mean, the reason they haven't talked about it probably is simply because there'd be a non-disclosure agreement signed by the Murdoch empire, in order to settle with Dominion voting machines out of court, Martin.
Well, I think Tucker Carlson has been removed because not so much for the sort of things he was saying there, which are fairly boilerplate, stuff. But I mean, he had various, he was the one that exposed the fact that EcoHealth Alliance were via the Pentagon, were funding the Wuhan lab, for example.
Yeah, well, Steve Hilton did that too, to be fair. But Tucker Carlson was really big on the biolabs in Ukraine story, for example, the US biolabs there.
That's right. So in other words, he's regarded by the left as a right winger, but the right wingers regard him as just unreliable from their point of view.
I remember also he was being threatened by the National Security Agency. This is one of the stories he did on his show. He was speaking to somebody. He said, "I'm from the National Security Agency, and we are basically all over you, and we're threat." It was a threat really from the NSA. Saying that they were put him completely under surveillance. Maybe they took all that surveillance. And the other thing, of course, is this Dominion story could potentially have been a sting, that someone came in giving him deliberately false information about Dominion, which he and his team decided they were going to put on air, which was a bit like the way Piers Morgan was gotten rid of from the Daily Mirror, because it was a sting, it was false information that was deliberately given to him, which he then published, and then he was removed.
Well, I think, as I just said, I think they had reasons for wanting to remove him anyway, not least because he's just not on the same page on the Ukraine, for example.
Well, I mean, the thing is also Rupert Murdoch will be looking at the bottom line saying, well, actually, although people love Tucker Carlson, he's not pulling the ads in.
That's right. So the big advertisers, for obvious reasons, don't like him. So even if you've got big ratings, it's not necessarily a plus. What I suspect may have happened, and then, again, as you say, speculation is necessary here, is that if this had come to court, it would have become clear that there was, in fact, no Dominion, that in actual fact, Trump lost fair and square. And, of course, this is what this court case would have shown. And if Dominion
possibly, guilty,
then it would be clear that. And of course,
I mean, these things are a bit like a poker game, aren't they? It may be you've got no real cards up your sleeve, but Rupert Murdoch's facing
the only reason he'd be facing losing his corporate empire is if, in actual fact, Dominion were not involved in vote rigging. Yeah, because that's the allegation that was made against.
I mean, I think it seems pretty obvious to me that all of these electronic voting companies, from top to bottom, are involved in some way in vote rigging.
But the point is, what they've done, Tony, is they've used the U.S. legal system, because they're quite wealthy, to sue people who say that and say, "We'll see you in court." Now, we've not seen any of this in court, which would be very interesting to see if indeed that was what was going on. Tucker Carlson played a role in that. I think what may be happening here is Murdoch has fallen out with Trump. That's the underlying thing. He is going to choose somebody else who he wants to be the Republican presidential candidate, and he and Trump have parted the ways.
Well, I think it's much more based around this court case, personally. I mean, there are two elements to it. First of all, is to understand that it's an out-of-court settlement that we're not allowed to know anything about because of a non-disclosure agreement. So you just have to kind of look at the DNA going on around the story to figure it out. So I think we've both pretty much well put our points of view. It's very sad, I think, that someone like Tucker does not have the massive audience that he should have anymore because he was able to get some brilliant stories out there.
Like Murdoch would argue, Tony, that Fox News belongs to him and he can decide who's on
it. Well, of course he would, yes. I mean, in any normal traditional idea of capitalism, Martin, you see, what would happen is Tucker would be snapped up by one of the other networks, but of course they are much more controlled. You'll probably be able
to make a living, Tony, doing something. And don't forget, he is a millionaire.
Well, no, but the thing is, what it does is it exposes just how fake this whole mass media is. Because, if he's someone that the advertisers don't like, it doesn't matter how many millions, the whole world could be watching him. But these big media bosses think, oh, well, actually, he's a bit of a liability, this guy. Even though the audience want him, we're going to get rid of him.
Well, that's because they can. And that's the way the system works. That's why we are here on an internet, radio show, because we can't get a platform doing it any other way. And that's because they're in power. Murdoch has shifted his loyalties and Tucker Carlson.
Well, I don't agree. I don't know. I don't necessarily think that. I mean, obviously, he was quite a bit a Trump loyalist, but, maybe he's shifting his loyalties towards someone else.
Murdoch is all in favor of war in the Ukraine. So Tucker Carlson going on about how this might not be a good idea, Murdoch ain't going to be happy with that, is he?
Well, maybe. I don't know that Murdoch is in favour of. Well, I don't know where you.
Oh,
get
I
that
think
from.
He is. He's on the record.
No, he would have signed off these things, Martin, in the past. So if his network is saying that the US has been creating illegal biological warfare laboratories in Ukraine, if Murdoch wanted to suppress that, he could easily have done that, but he didn't. Can I just go look at a couple of stories before we have our final item? The far right party has joined formal talks to form Finland's next government. In Finland's future, back to the far right. The far right Finns party joined official talks to form the next government in Finland, a move that will give the Nordic nation its most right wing government in 100 years. History should serve as a guide, not as a justification for repeating past mistakes. What about this? Isn't that interesting? Finland has just joined NATO and suddenly swerved to the far right.
Well, I think the swerve to the far right probably explains them joining NATO, if you see what I mean. There was a civil war in Finland in the 1920s between the right and the left, and it was eventually settled. The left were defeated, but they were then incorporated into the system. And it's actually got quite an interesting and unique history, Finland. It's sad to see the right wing coming to power in all these Scandinavian countries. But, the world is forming into two blocks now. The Finns used to make quite a lot of money trading with the Soviet Union, being an intermediary between the West and the Russians.
Now the Turks have taken over, haven't they? The Turks are doing that now.
Well, exactly. So what will happen, as I said about the Poles earlier, they're cheering on the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, Sikorsky saying thank you, United States, on Twitter. When the German economy collapses, the Polish economy will collapse because they don't do any trade with the Russians anymore. They will not have any, the idea that they're going to be successful by wrecking the German economy is simply wrong, and everybody's going to suffer. It's going to be horrible.
The Russians have put out a statement this week. On Wednesday, the transfer of depleted uranium weapons by the UK to the Ukrainian government. On the 25th of April, the Minister of State at the UK Ministry of Defence, James Heapy, confirmed Ukrainian side is being supplied with armour-piercing shells of depleted uranium. He stated that London is not monitoring the development of these weapons, deployment, and has no obligation to eliminate the consequences of their use after the conflict. James Heapy's comments are a grim testament, say the Russians, to the ruthlessness of the Anglo-Saxon policy of an all-out escalation and a proxy conflict they themselves have unleashed in Ukraine. We call, he says, on the British authorities not to indulge in illusory hopes that they will be able to get off scot-free by making the armed forces of Ukraine accountable for the toxic ammunition now at their disposal. London will not succeed in shifting blame to its Kiev clients for their crimes. The Russians aiming this 100% at London, Martin.
Well, they would, wouldn't they? From their point of view, it's an escalation because, of course, this DU depleted uranium spreads around and causes all kinds of problems, for example, for commercial agriculture subsequently. And at some point we may trigger over into a situation where the British are regarded. I've read a very interesting article this morning, about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline bombing. It's on Global Research. It's not by Seymour Hersh. And it's suggesting that British personnel may have been involved in the attack, including the Royal Navy, which is what I originally suspected. Ultimately, of course, in the Nuremberg court that's going to be held at the end of World War III, Britain will have to justify that, and they'll have to pay compensation to all the people who've lost out as a result of our terrorist activities. And of course, anybody involved in it should go to prison, and life should mean life. But is that going to happen? Probably not. In that case, the Russians will fight on, because it's war then, isn't it? We're not talking about legal procedures anymore. It's winning and losing.
No, we're certainly not. Also, another I think found fascinating little story here is in fortune.com. Four Americans. Oh, and by the way, the website, I think it's Kennedy24.com, is for RFK's presidential bid. Well worth checking in there. Four Americans from a black empowerment organization, in big inverted commas, worked with Russian intelligence to spread propaganda, say the FBI. The four Americans affiliated with Black Empowerment and political organization have been charged, along with three Russians, with conspiring to covertly sow discord in U.S. society, spread Russian propaganda, and interfere illegally in U.S. elections. Oh, yeah, not the Dominion voting machines, of course. According to an indictment unsealed on Tuesday, the U.S. citizens and two Russians were added to an existing case in Tampa, Florida, involving Alexander Ionov, prescribed by prosecutors as the founder of a Moscow-based organization funded by the Russian government to carry out a clandestine influence campaign in the US. The four Americans are all part of the African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru movement, which has locations in St. Petersburg, Florida, and St. Louis. Among those charges are Marley Yeshitela, chairman of the US-based organization, which was raided by the FBI last summer when Ionov was initially charged. Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service allegedly weaponized our First Amendment rights, freedoms Russia denies to its own citizens, to divide Americans and interfere in elections in the U.S., Assistant Attorney General Matthew Olson of the Justice Department's National Security Division said. The department will not hesitate to expose and prosecute those who sow discord and corrupt U.S. elections in service of hostile foreign interests, regardless of whether the culprits are U.S. citizens or foreign individuals abroad, Olson said in a news release. So, I mean, they seem to be implying here that by speaking their mind, they're obviously saying they're only doing it because they're being paid to do it by the Russians. By speaking their mind, these people apparently are fixing U.S. elections for the Russians, Martin.
Well, I believe the president of this African Socialist Party, minor party in the U.S., of course, no chance of getting elected under first past the post, he said, well, the problem is not that I work for the Russians, it's just that I don't work for them. And they're going to use the war as a method of dealing, of creating enemies within and all the rest of it. They've done it before. The Black Panthers were completely deconstructed by the FBI and the CIA. So Fred Hampton was assassinated. Various other people were smeared. People had to flee. I mean, eventually, Eldridge Cleaver's living in Algeria. I mean, we're going, you know, this is the dark side of the US. The idea that anybody who criticizes government policy must be working for a foreign power, because there's nothing to criticize in government policy. The government is obviously right. So if you're criticizing them, it must be because you've been put up to it by some evil foreign power.
When they talk about weaponizing our First Amendment rights, they're basically saying that the First Amendment is now null and void, aren't they?
Well, basically they are in the case of these people, but it's pretty much null and void in the case of Julian Assange.
So their freedom of speech is not a right anymore. It's just if they're saying something which is pro-Russian, then that's not included as freedom of speech. It's working for the FSB.
Well, that's right. That is right. That is exactly what they're saying. And because the spread of support for the West policy on Ukraine has been quite wide. So people who oppose the Iraq war have, for some bizarre reason, decided that the West is in the right over the Ukraine. They feel that they're empowered to move against the minority which is speaking out. But, of course, First Amendment rights, your right to say that the government is wrong, are fundamental. If you haven't got the right to say that the government are wrong, then you haven't got any right to say anything at all, really.
No, you may as well...
Say you can.
Yes, you may as well be living in a totalitarian system and state. Anyway, look, we haven't got time for Cynthia Chung. Ever so sorry. We'll definitely do that next week, Martin. But we're going to wind up this week with Vera Sharav, a very important, I think, brilliant little documentary series that she's been putting together. It's called Never Again Is Now. And she's been looking particularly at the pandemic and that some of the experimentation on humans that's been going on during that, and comparing it to her previous generation in her family's Nazi Holocaust. So let's have a listen to that finally.
Those who are responsible for the pandemic have used two of the weapons that the Nazis used, which was fear and propaganda. Propaganda feeds the fear, foments it, hardens it. At that time, the fear was against Jews who were accused of being spreaders of infectious disease. The thing that I realized and was horrified by was that medicine under the Nazis had been totally taken over by government. And so I realized that panic was being fomented so that people would lose confidence in their ability to discern things. And so the best way is listen to public health officials, the experts.
The thing that'll get us back to the world that we had before coronavirus is the vaccine and getting that out to all 7 billion people.
Bill Gates assumes the mantle of one who has authority in the medical public health field.
There has never been a public health. The only health that ever existed is the individual's health. Every single medical procedure or medical practice needs to be considered with regards to how does it affect this individual patient? Is it necessary?
Why did all of you cooperate? And here's the interesting answer. The Nazis never presented themselves as negative, destructive people. They presented themselves as a party who is trying actually to make things better. And that's what they taught people. When you were taken to a ghetto, it was for your own protection. When you were taken to a camp, you were told, we have work for you there, and food, and shelter. We want to help you.
My grandfather, who was in the French army, he got into camps, and he always feared after that normal doctors. He saw them doing all kinds of experiments on people, entering the barracks with huge syringes and things like that.
There were people sent in Australia to camps. They didn't kill them there, but the process that we're going through is part of what they were doing to them. Most people just think, well, we need to do what the government says, and they want what is good for us, and they trust them, and they think that's the way it is. It's so scary that you can understand what happened there, that it happens again.
It's a deja vu, you know, I feel exactly. I mean, people tell us what to do now. People are telling us how to do, how to go, what to shop.
We went like sheep in the Second World War.
it's happening now all over the world with this COVID. I'm against people who are telling me what to do with my body, because it's a lie. It's a big lie. When people are so blind, I can't stand it. I have to try to convince them to open their eyes, to open their ears, not to go like sheep.
So that's Never Again is now, 2023 trailer. I think there's 10 different sections to it, 10 parts of it. The Alliance for Human Research Protection, which is something that Vera Sharab in the States has set up, Alliance for Human Research Protection. In other words, don't experiment on us, please. Thank you very much. Never Again is now. What do you make of that, Martin? Vera Sharab, I mean, we had last week, didn't we, the Wall Street, the Nazis and the deep state. Really, what many of people are describing, including her there, is a kind of a Fourth Reich, isn't it?
It is, but I think you've got to distinguish between then and now. I mean, if we're focusing just on the medical aspects of things, the Nazis did abuse medical science. They certainly did. But that wasn't the only thing they did.
And so did the Japanese. What she's saying about deja vu is very important, I think.
I think it is. But I think that the real problem is not medical tyranny. It's tyranny with medical aspects to it. We are moving into World War III, because World War II led to a situation where capitalism remained intact and the deep state metamorphosed. The Nazis, the original Nazis, were absorbed into the NATO intelligence structure. And ultimately, of course, World War III must mean the destruction of NATO. It's got to go. And, that's what we're up against. And of course, the plandemic, and it was a plandemic, is part of all of that, but it's only one part. People in Sudan aren't dying from medical interventions that are inappropriate. They're dying because there's a war.
No, but I think what Vera's not really talking about that, Martin. I think you have to understand a documentary generally, when it's made, is about a specific thing. And it's
yes,
not
I know.
And
also,
everything.
Can I just comment on the documentary?
No documentary is really about everything, is it?
Why do we need the doomy music? It's just a personal thing.
Well, that's what you generally do in documentaries. Anyway, look, time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also particularly to Shane Collins and Dave Douglas for our debate, which will be up on our show page later tonight, the audio and hopefully the video over the weekend too. At thisweek.org.uk, and also, of course, to our video engineer and sound engineer, Dave Bazanko, this week. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Please do send me interviews and story tips, like someone did this week with the UK Column, talking about Marvin Rees, the Bristol Mayor. Fascinating, and it's interesting, I think, to dig out a previous clip saying something similar from a few years ago, which was censored, and we had our knuckles wrapped for. Even though, of course, it seems to be very prophetic. Maybe that's why they didn't like it, you know, talking about Bristol Happy City and the Centre for Thriving Places and these bizarre organisations which are there to sort of brainwash you into the thinking that you're not having a hard time when you're being destroyed by the deep state, your government and the Fourth Reich. So do please send me interviews and story tips via my email, probably, or elsewhere via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast and full-length interviews and story links and comment page. And our email address is at thisweek.org.uk. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. I'm going to carry on tomorrow here at the Journalist Union Conference. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, talkradio.org.uk. At 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.